Sitting here talking about great classic horror movies. Dr. Terry Yamauchi is here today. Good to have him with us. And we were just talking about the original The Thing. The Thing from Outer Space is what they renamed it. And that was the first film credit for James Arness, who went on to play Matt Dillon. He played the monster. That's what he played the vegetable, I guess. But he was in that movie. And that still, it comes on, I'll watch it.
Yeah, me too. It was just on last week.
But using the Geiger counter to heighten the tension of it and everything. It's well done. But it was who directed it, right? Howard Hawks.
Oh yeah, that's right.
You know, Howard Hawks directed it. I mean, he did all the great westerns and stuff, and he decided to do a horror movie. Yeah. It was a very pro-democracy movie, anti-communism, and that was when the Red Scare was all going on.
Right, and the military was directing what they could do and what they couldn't do. And,
it's a great movie. I was, if you've listened to the show for the almost 20 years that I've been on the air, you know that I had James Arness on one time. I've got a signed copy of his autobiography that he wrote. And I wanted to talk about that movie and them. I mean, I could care less about Gunsmoke, okay? I wanted to talk about the horror movies. And he said one of the funniest things that ever happened to him was when they were doing The Thing, he and several of the people got they had the roach coaches out on set, and the food wasn't very good. So he and one of his co-stars, he did not say who it was, went to a hamburger joint, kind of like a Sonic today where you drive up. But back then, you know, the waitresses had they came out with the roller skates, and they had the tray that they hung on your window and all that. And he said that they had let in their order, and then it was a hot day. They rolled the windows down, and they were sitting in the car. He was in the passenger side, and the lady came right out. You're going to love this, Russ. Lady comes out to deliver their food and just lets out a blood-curdling scream and drops the tray right there in the parking lot. And, you know, I mean, he's going, what the crap, right? And then he forgot that he had his right arm all made up for the movie, and so it was made up like some extraterrestrial's arm, and it was green and scaly and had plant-like things growing out of it and everything, and she just totally freaked out about it. It's a great story.
Yeah,
James Arness was a very interesting artist. You know who his brother was, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Peter Graves.
Yeah, right? Peter Graves, who made another great monster. You know, Arness did Them, where he fought giant ants. Peter Graves did Beginning of the End, where they fought giant grasshoppers.
Yeah, I still remember being so scared when you heard the Them.
Oh,
the,
yeah.
You know, that cricket-like thing.
Yeah, that had to be done by a violin or something that they did.
I don't know, but that really creeped me out.
Yeah, well, it was a creepy movie.
My next-door neighbor and I went to the movie. In those days, you know, you could go anywhere. And we were
had to
walk around 10 blocks to go from downtown to our house in Portland.
Yeah.
And I remember we were so scared. Well, I mean, we were like 8 years old, nine years old. And we were so scared.
That big ant's going to come get you.
Well, when we came home, we didn't walk on the sidewalk. We walked right down the middle of the street.
Oh, that's good. So you were the pre-Antifa then, if you were walking down the middle of the street, huh? You're blocking traffic? Is that what you were doing?
There wasn't any traffic.
Just saying. It's so sad that our country is the way it is now. That kids cannot have what we had when we were younger.
Right, right. But I want to just tell you, you look so good.
I feel great.
I'm so glad that you're on your well into your recovery stage. You look really, really good. So,
well here's what's funny about it, though, Doctor, is that I'd sit. Dr. Driscoll is my main doctor over at the Wound Center. And then I got Dr. Seal, who's infectious diseases, and I see her ever so often. And she's got me on these antibiotics for 6 weeks. But anyway, I felt good the day they put me in the hospital. I think I told you that. I showed up, and this infection had just blown up on my foot. And Driscoll looked at me and said, I'm going to put you in the hospital, Dave. And I said, why? I feel great. And she didn't tell me. She told Linda about 4 days later that she feared for my life at that moment. She said, he did not look good. He acted like he felt great. I said, it wasn't acting. It was true. I felt great. She said, I looked like death warmed over. I didn't have any color or anything. She said she thought if I'd come in a day or later, they'd been fighting for my life.
Well,
this MRSA must be really bad. That's all I know.
Well, we could talk. I guess we will talk a little bit about that. But I know you're on antibiotics, and
yep,
you
ought to be 24/7.
You've got to be, you know, carry out those orders. I know your infectious disease doctor probably thinks that I'm a meddler.
Did you call her?
No.
You might have called her.
I was ready. You know, if somebody called me, but I have another friend that also has a problem with MRSA,
uh-huh,
and now has a problem with something called a Clostridium difficile, which is a bacteria that you get, an infection that you get if you're on antibiotics for too long.
Oh no!
And it's not a super bug, but it's one that the effect of that having antibiotics, it starts growing in your body, and it can be
yuck.
Yeah, that's why, you know, you're asking about superbugs today a little bit.
Yeah,
is appropriate, and she has the same doctor, and she also mentioned that, well, Dr. Yamauchi has done this and this.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, dear, that doctor's
thinking. Yeah, because I mentioned to her that I had talked to you first.
Looking,
you know,
over her shoulders. Who in the heck is this guy that's talking to my
yeah,
patients? And he's a pediatrician, and these people are older people.
Yeah. I'm just telling you that, you know, when I talk to you about it, you know, I just about take your whatever you say as gospel.
Well,
when it comes to infectious diseases, you've been dealing with them forever.
Well, I've been dealing with your infection or your past infection, your ongoing treatment for a long, long time. That was one of my interests. And so, you know, it used to be a bacteria that we see only associated with healthcare places like the hospital or clinics.
Right, that's why they try to get you out of the hospital as fast as they can.
And now we see more of it in, you know, the public because people don't take their antibiotics for the period of time. And one of my contributions was finding it in pets.
That's right.
Pets were carrying it.
There's people that I run into who say, a guy you got on that talks about diseases, what's he got against dogs going into the hospital? And I said, didn't you listen to what he had to say? You know, and they go, well, not really. I said, next time he's on, I'll ask him again, and he'll explain it to you. So the floor is yours.
Well, you know, I kind of got the attention of the infectious disease world. This is, gosh, close to 20 years ago. I don't know, a long time ago. But we were allowing animals from the zoo, petting zoo, or from the zoo to come see the children or children to see them. And I said, wait a minute, before we do that, let's find out what kind of germs these animals carry. It actually started out with a kangaroo, believe it or not.
Somebody, I didn't just see that.
They wanted to bring a kangaroo in and give out a company that I guess they had. The kangaroo was their icon.
Their mascot.
Okay. They wanted to bring a kangaroo to the hospital. And I said, gee, I would rather, you know, it's a great idea. The kids would be looking at this kangaroo.
Yeah, they'd love it.
And the newspapers would be there and stuff. And I said, well, I'm not going to say yes, that I would approve, but I don't know for sure. But it's going to be so cute. And, you know, I said, what kind of germs does it carry? And they looked at each other like, what? And I said, I won't approve that until I know. I said, you can go to the board and override me. But I knew the board wasn't going to say, yeah, you can bring a kangaroo. And if Dr. Yamauchi says no.
Yeah.
You know. And so they did bring, they brought a cardboard cutout of a kangaroo.
Okay.
You know? And then so somebody, like weird listener or something, might have called and said, well, you know, you let the dogs and cats, what about, then the kids go home, they got dogs and cats at home. And I said, that's a good question. So I took some students out, and we went to the zoo first and cultured things that they brought from the petting zoo, like lizards and toads and owls and alligator. And sure enough, they had all kinds of bad, bad things. And so I said, these are what they carry around. And then that's when somebody said, well, what about dogs and cats? They're more common, and the kids go home to them. So I said, well, I'll look. And sure enough, some of those dogs and cats were carrying the same MRSA organism that now is such a crime. And I published that and presented it at a national meeting. And
did everybody kind of go,
yes.
Say what?
Yeah, and I showed pictures, you know, people kissing on dogs, you know, putting a piece of meat in their mouth and having a dog or cat eat it. And I had a nice cartoon saying, if you thought about all the places your dog or cat sat on your furniture and the germs that they left, you know, you'd have to move.
Well,
and that's where it kind of got started.
I thought of you a couple of weeks ago. You know those Mayhem commercials?
Yeah.
Have you seen the one where he's pretending he's like the puppy?
Yes.
And he's licking on Tina Fey, and Tina Fey says, I know where your mouth was this morning. Get away from me. You know? And it's the truth.
Well, that's it. That's exactly it. And if you think about it, and people say, well, I never got it. I said, well, so you, of course. Now, you are a high-risk person right now.
Yeah.
And so
I stay away from people with diseases right now.
So you have to be very, very careful. So, you know, people don't think of that. And most people are normal, healthy, and it probably isn't at high risk. But if you think about it, just like you just said, you think, well, maybe he's not so crazy.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, my grandson didn't get to come to Thanksgiving at my house. Because he had something that's running through kids right now that I heard about, this hand, foot, and mouth disease or whatever. And he got it.
Yep.
He got it.
I just told that story last night.
And my daughter says, oh, come on, Dad. And I go, no, you don't understand. I've been taking antibiotics now for 4 weeks. I don't have much of a immune system probably right now. Probably not a good thing to have him wanting to sit in my lap.
This is too good. This is too much of a coincidence. When I was a doctor on staff at UCLA, where I trained, they have a system there that if you pick up a patient, you start taking care of a patient, that's your patient for as long as that patient lives or as you live or you're there.
Okay.
And so I had this young girl come in. And she was just a delightful girl, little girl, young girl.
Yeah.
And she had a sister. They always came together, and their mother brought them. And their mother was Janet Leigh.
Mm.
Okay, so who would the daughter be?
Yeah, Janet Leigh. I'm trying to think really fast here off the top of my head.
Janet Leigh was married to?
Tony Curtis.
Okay, so.
Okay, Jamie Lee Curtis.
That's exactly right.
Okay.
So she
six degrees of separation. No, I'm just kidding.
Well, that's what I'm saying. That's what.
Yeah.
So she comes in. She's got a high fever, and she said, you know, she's got these sores in her mouth. And I said, oh, yeah, I know exactly what that is. And I said, I'll bet you if we take off her shoes, we're going to see some of these little sores and rash on her feet. And they looked at me, you know, And I said, and there it was. And I said, I got the residents to come into the room. And, of course, she's mother's in there, you know, how gorgeous she was.
Yes.
And here's this young girl that was about, I think, 10, 11, maybe, I don't remember exactly. And so I was giving this great teaching lessons to the young doctors. And, of course, they're not even looking at my patient or me.
Of course not.
They're looking at mother.
Sure.
You know, it's almost a comedy because the patient's on one side, and they're looking at the other side of the room. And finally...
Hey! Attention!
Finally, mother says, doctor says, what are you talking about? And I said, look, she says, your daughter's got these sores on her hands and on her feet and in her mouth.
Yeah, in her mouth.
And I said, this is hand, foot, and mouth disease. I don't know if I should say this on your show, but she says, doctor, you're me.
No, you're asking me.
And it's America's sweetheart, right?
Right, right.
And that's and I always ask. I show the picture of the lesions in the in Jamie Lee's mouth, and the question on the quiz is not what this disease is, but who the actress is.
Yeah,
you know, and people get it, of course, after a while.
I got you, but that's interesting, for the simple reason that. You got a situation, and I'll be honest, I never even heard of hand, foot, and mouth. The only thing I've heard about was cow disease, you know, the cow disease. That's what I'd heard.
Yeah, and that's what most people think about.
And my daughter said, well, no, well, we took him over to the kids' hospital, and they identified it immediately and said that there's a major outbreak going on right now. So that'd be an easy one to pass around, absolutely.
Yes, and usually it's not major serious, but it can be. You know, it can cause.
Well, he sure didn't feel good, and he ran a fever. And my daughter said, you know, I said, well, is he still running a fever? Yes, can't come. And she was like, but Dad, I go, look, sweetheart, I'm not trying to be mean, but I got to take protection for myself on
that's
this one.
Good for you. Good, and you're. Thinking, that's what I like about the practice of medicine and teaching, because if you get people to start thinking like that, you know, thinking, wait a minute, you know, this is common sense.
Well, it seemed that way to me. The last thing I want to do is somebody's got an infectious disease to
you're
be around.
Learning. I'm going
to
give you a degree pretty soon.
Yeah, well, I'm learning a lot from you. All right, we're going to get our first break in. Dr. Terry Yamauchi is here. We got a lot of things to talk about. Of course, immunization is something that's going to come up. We're going to talk about that. Measles is out and about and doing its thing again. We want to talk about that. And we've got to talk about the flu, because I got my flu shot. I get one every year. I know people say, it doesn't work, or I'm going to end up with a flu. Every time I get a flu shot, I get the flu. Here's the bottom line. Get the flu shot. If it's not the right flu,
we'll talk about it.
At least it'll cut down on how bad the flu is that you will get. All right, back here on the Dave Elswick Show. It's 28 after. We got about a minute and a half before we get to the news. Dr. Terry Yamauchi is here. I do so much better with your name now.
Yes, you do.
You know, first couple times I had you on, man, I had, you know, I'm the Harry Carey of names on talk radio. So I really butchered his name several times, and he's been so really nice about not saying I'm never coming on your show again.
Well, you know.
So Superbugs, they have come about because we prescribed too many antibiotics for a lot of things that we shouldn't have been taking them for, and they've gotten... You know, where it doesn't bother them, and now we got some battles going on.
Exactly. You know, right now, you know, we're worried about the flu, and people are going in with fever and, you know, different symptoms. And so often, the physician or nurse will say, well, you know, I'm not sure. Let's put you on some antibiotics.
Yeah. I've heard that.
You hear it all the time. It's very common. And I can't go against the doctors who say that because, you know, they are trying to protect you, and there are other infections that are caused by bacteria that can be treated. Sinusitis, strep throat, things like that need antibiotics.
Mm-hmm.
But flu is caused by a virus, and that cannot be treated with an antibiotic. So we get all of these people that are taking antibiotics out there, lots of people taking antibiotics, and those antibiotics, only the only thing they do is take care, get rid of other bacteria that aren't causing symptoms, really. And therefore, those bacteria are being exposed to antibiotics, and over a long period of time become resistant.
So. All right. Hold your thought. We'll come back. We'll talk more. News is next. Give you 60 seconds. Be back in a moment.
Good, Ben.
All right. We're back. Yeah, we're talking about Tom Cruise now. We talk movies all the time.
Let me
just tell you what. If there's somebody, maybe other than Zach, who loves movies as much as I do, it's Dr. Terry Yamauchi. He's a big cinephile. He really, really is. And so is Zach. And Zach, as he's walking out, I was talking to him about the Amazon, what was that, Jack?
Jack Ryan.
Yeah, the Jack Ryan series. First season was awesome. This season was really good until the last two episodes.
I think that the first season had the mystery, not only behind, you know, the bad guy, but also behind Jack Ryan.
Yeah.
He has a mystery, like, okay, is he just this nerd, this office junkie?
Yeah.
No, it's more to him.
Well, a lot more came out this season about him again, but did it seem like to you that they felt like they had to wrap it up real fast, and it was like everything just suddenly fell into place,
right?
You know?
And plus, you know, we were expecting something, and then it totally went another way.
Yeah. You know, I wanted him to kill the guy from Venezuela,
the president.
Yeah, I wanted him to go ahead and put a bullet in his head. I really did. Did you notice how they didn't let that happen?
Right.
And at the end of the show, I forget, the senator is talking to him. He said, "Well, what do you want?"
Yeah.
"The president's dead." Talking about, I mean, that's how they wrapped that up. And I'm like, wow, how long in the timeline are we here, you know, kind of thing. But anyway, enough of that. Let's get back to talking with Dr. Yamauchi here. Have you watched that show yet?
No.
Oh, it's really good. It's good. What's his name? Kaslowski, is that his name?
Krasinski.
Krasinski, yeah. He's the Emily Blunt's wife, or husband. He's the guy who wrote A Quiet Place. Did you see that movie? Yeah, he wrote that movie for her. The second one's coming out this year. He's written that as well. And he's just really good. What was he in, Parks and Recreation?
That's correct.
Yeah, he was really good in that,
too. I think he was in The Office as well.
Yeah, they were really good. He's a good actor. Emily Blunt, though, is awesome. I just watched Mary Poppins Returns again. And she was really good in that movie. I mean, she studied Mary Poppins.
That's right.
For months, she said. And when she's like coming, you know how she comes out of the sky at the very beginning with her umbrella, you know, and she floats down? She had her feet exactly like Julie Andrews had hers in the original. It was pretty cool.
The only downside to that movie was the music. It was not memorable. That was the only downside.
But how many movies can you write that you write supercalifragilisticexpialidocious or Let's Go Fly a Kite? Or I Love to Laugh. I mean, all of those great songs out of that first movie, they were incredible. Of course, they had a gun to their heads. Remember, you know, you saw the movie about how he had to get Mrs. Banks to go along with it, you know, to make the movie.
Yeah.
That's what was going on. I remember that's a great scene in that movie when, Emma Thompson plays Mrs. Banks in that movie, and they walk in and the Tom Hanks, who's playing Walt Disney, says, "Guys, play one of the songs for him." They go right into supercalifragilistic, and she goes, "Supercali, whatever? I don't think so." I love that movie. It's a good movie as well.
Yeah,
all right, enough of that. Let's go back to Superbugs.
Well, let's finish that quickly.
Yeah.
Okay. The reason we're seeing the problem with that is, of course, inappropriate use. But part of the inappropriate use is on the patient. They don't take all the medicines they're supposed to take when, you know, for the period of time.
Okay, can I ask you to make a point about this? Because people get diagnosed with tuberculosis.
Yes.
We've had a problem with this on the border, people coming in from Mexico and stuff, and they got tuberculosis. They give them the necessary drugs to kill the disease, but they don't finish up how many tablets they
got. Exactly. Sometimes they sell them. Sometimes they give them to somebody else, you know, to say. Sometimes they give them to somebody that's got some other symptoms to say, this, take this. Now, again, some of those antibiotics that are given are not drugs that kill the organism. They're called static drugs. So they put the organism in sort of a neutral position. They're not multiplying. And if they stop them too soon, they just sit there, and then pretty soon they start multiplying again. But they have a little bit of resistance to the medicine that was given. So if you're given a medicine, you should take all of it. You shouldn't keep it around the house because it gets old and it's going to lose its potency if you don't use it. So those are the kind of reasons why we're seeing bugs that are resistant.
Yeah, and it's kind of scary because it's only got so many antibiotics.
And we're running out. There are now organisms that we cannot treat, the superbugs. And there are some organisms that have a little bit of resistance, so we're having to hit them with more than one antibiotic, sometimes using two. And then the problem that arises with that is that we get other bacteria that become prevalent that may not be causing a problem right now, but they exist from the treatment that they've been exposed to. And now when you stop the antibiotic, they become more prevalent and cause disease. So, you know, there's two sides to why you see it. You don't take it enough. You don't take it long enough. It's given inappropriately. You're not treating a certain bacteria that they think is there. So, yes, that's why we're seeing superbugs. We can't make them fast enough, antibiotics fast enough. It's a tremendous job research-wise to get, because you have to treat lots and lots of people for a long time to see how effective it is.
See if it's really working.
Yeah.
I mean, the one that they're using on me is, it's penicillin, but it's coupled with another antibiotic.
Yes, that's why.
Give it a double punch.
And then in the old days, penicillin killed everything.
Oh, everything.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Not so much anymore.
That's right.
Depending on what part of the world you happen to go into.
Well, yeah, and the world's a lot smaller now with jet flights and things like that.
Watch Planet of the Apes. No, anyway.
Can't get you off the movies.
You can't.
I know.
Because I know that you use that scene in the movie when you're doing presentations. Okay, so let's come back. Let's talk about some of the things that are going on in the state. Mumps are back in the news.
Back again. Remember, we had that last year.
Yes, we did.
We had the more cases of mumps in our state of Arkansas than in any other state in the union.
And that goes back to the Marshallese, correct?
That's where we first saw the outbreak occurring. The first patients we discovered were from the Marshallese.
Right. Mm-hmm. Okay.
And we controlled that. Wonderful job with the Centers for Disease Control and our health department, getting the word out, getting the vaccine out, getting the case finding out, explored and discovering that, and holding the large scale vaccine clinics. We got that under control pretty well.
Okay.
And now we're starting to see a few more slipping in. I don't have any information on the basic epidemiology of the more recent. It's not large scale like we had, last year.
Well, last year was big.
Yeah.
It was big. It made national news.
Well, I say we had more than our state than the whole any other state in the union.
Yeah,
and we actually had investigators from the centers come to Arkansas to help and review and help manage the program.
So let's just work. I mean, look, we shouldn't be even having to talk about some of this stuff, okay? For the simple reason that we had to defeat it and we had just about gotten rid of it, and then people started reading some dumb stuff on the internet, listening to women posing nude in Playboy, and started not getting their kids inoculated. And the herd mentality only works if everybody is getting their kids inoculated.
Getting the non-vaccinated, not necessarily just kids, but non-vaccinated people to try to keep this down.
Now, I don't know if you know this or not. from what you know, these people that are coming across the border that at least we capture, are we giving them the inoculations that they should be getting?
Not on any large scale.
That's really good news.
That I know of. I'm sure that some of them are, but that's nothing that is not something that is being publicized right now. That's an excellent point, and it's an excellent, you know, health preventative health measure that we should be trying to carry
out.
Well,
I have a lot of doctors and nurses on my show, as you know, all right? And I got to tell you, it's a bone of contention for them. They're really concerned about people coming into this country and spreading disease. And nobody wants to talk about it because it's not politically correct. Well, you know what? I don't give a damn. You know, bottom line, you know, it's putting Americans at risk. Yeah. Period.
When you're such a nice guy, you know.
I just say what everybody's thinking, Doc. I know what they're thinking. And they're thinking like I am.
It is a problem. We need to have the awareness, and thank God for people like you who keep raising that awareness. People should be saying, you know, I don't know if my child is protected, or I don't know if the neighbor's protected, because if they're not, maybe I'm not.
What happened when I was in school, all right, same time as you were? We had to get our inoculations or you couldn't go to school. What happened to that?
Well, it's still there, but nobody's not enough. It's not enforced well enough.
Why not? Everybody know. I mean, take a look now. We got mumps of running around. We got measles going crazy. I mean, why? We could get rid of all of that stuff. And now we got this disease that looks like polio, but they say it's not polio, but it sure looks like polio.
Yeah, but polio, if we use the polio vaccine, that would not be effective against this particular disease.
Right.
But it would protect from polio if that had to come, you know, behind this. That's one of the basic premises of going out and getting mumps vaccine again, because you know, it'll protect against mumps, but if you're not exposed and it doesn't become a problem right now, it'll protect you down the line. Mm-hmm. if you have that vaccine on board, just like measles. You know, get that and it'll protect you down the line, even if you're not exposed right now.
I mean, I understand to a point. If you have religious beliefs that preclude you from doing this with your children,
we have a lot of people that suddenly have suddenly have religion.
Yeah, I got you.
Yeah, but that leads into the idea of the herd immunity. The more people that we protect, the better off we will be. Now, again, I can say that this kind of leads us into the influenza problem, because you know we have a vaccine that we've touted for influenza. And in the past, it hasn't been as good as we thought it would be. But it is protected a lot of people from dying.
Sure.
Last year, the vaccine that we had, there was a virus that floated around that wasn't in the vaccine. And therefore, we had a little more problem with flu last year. This year, we have a couple vaccines, but with the vaccine that's out there available is good for three different flu mm-hmm. viruses. Actually, there's one out there that's good for four viruses.
Wow.
Well, four influenza viruses. One that you and I need to take, mm-hmm. That's for older persons.
Yeah, that's like a double shot, man. It's amazing. We're filling you up, Dave. Here we go.
Well, you know, if we don't get that particular vaccine with the four viruses, then that one virus that's not in that becomes prevalent and we aren't going to get protected.
Right.
But on the other hand, if any of the other three are prevalent or starts floating around, then we're protected. And when I say protected, it may protect us really well and we have no symptoms. It may protect us and we have a few minor symptoms. It may protect us and keep us from dying. You know, so you know there are some pluses for all the vaccines since there's so little side effects around. But you got to get it to go and protect you.
All right. When we come back, is it still a good time to get vaccinated for the flu? We'll talk with Dr. Yamauchi about that as we return, and we'll finish up with him on the Dave Ellswick Show. All right, we got 7 minutes left here with Dr. Terry Yamauchi. And if you're not hearing this live, that's okay, because it's important stuff. We try to play these best of shows, and I'm sure during the Christmas week you might get a chance to hear it again. But anyway, Dr. Yamauchi, is it too late? Now, the date today, we're in the first week of December. So is it too late to get your flu shot?
No. No, we see influenza into May, and so we really recommend, strongly recommending people to go ahead and get it right up until, you know, May.
Okay, so let's say you get it in September, okay, which is kind of early.
Yeah.
All right, but you get it in September. Should you go in and say, hey, can I get a booster? Is there any way of getting a booster with your flu shot?
Well, it's not recommended.
Okay.
Influenza is the vaccine is one of those vaccines that the protection takes about 10 days, 2 weeks to start getting real protective levels of protective levels.
Yeah, I know what you're saying.
Okay, but it starts dropping off. We start seeing a little bit of decrease in the protection, not enough that would be a real worry, but it does start dropping off. So you can get the vaccine. We're really thinking about the 2 weeks, 10 days, 2 weeks before you have maximum protection all through the seasons, and we recommend that.
Over Thanksgiving, had some people over visiting with me, and one was talking about riding in an airplane, and you know, you're sitting next to a person and they're coughing and wheezing and sneezing. He said he had decided that from now on he's going to wear one of those masks when he's traveling like that.
That's fine. It's
how good does that work, though? I mean,
it's not very. It's not very good. It only works if you breathe out.
Oh, okay. Okay.
It's not.
So you're protecting everybody else, not so much. You're getting protected from everybody.
The main thing that does is it kind of warns people that there's infections going around, but I don't advocate that when you're traveling. Really, I'll tell you, my wife is, bless her, she is, you know, a huge advocate for germs, against germs.
Okay.
And we get on an airplane, and she carries with these handy wipe packages and wipes down the trays in front of her and the seat in front of her and the belt and, you know, hands it to me, and I feel kind of funny, you know, doing it. But she's...
But I've read that that stuff is not as effective as they'd like you to believe.
Well, of course, everybody think that it's really, really... And it does, you know, you can see dirt on it when... sometimes, and makes you feel like you're doing something. But it does have some. It's just like, be sure you're washing your hands. That's more effective to wash your hands than to use that. But again, you don't know if a dog sat on that tray or something. So, you know, it does. I'm not going to say on the air that my wife, you know, is that crazy, but she sometimes goes overboard with that, and if she's somebody sneezing around,
better safe than sorry.
Sitting next to her, or something, she'll hand them a handy wipe and say, "Here, you know, we might want to use this."
Yeah, I'll be honest with you. I use the wipes when I go into the big box store, and I'm going to grab hold of one of those carts.
I do too. I always do that, and
just makes sense.
So when I leave the store, sometimes I'll take one to my car and wipe my steering wheel off.
That's even more important. Maybe wipe off the face of your phone, too.
Oh, that's, yeah, that's...
That's a cesspool. You know, there's more, just for my listeners, this is going to make you feel really good. There are more germs on your phone than there is on your toilet seat.
There's more on your desk.
Yeah. Keyboard. All of those things.
Yeah.
Because you sneeze on it and you do all kinds of things with it. I agree. All right. We're out of time.
That's great.
Got to get you back on in January. I like to do a show. This is something that I have been amazed by. I mean, I have not. I had five-way bypass 3 years ago.
Oh yeah.
But it's been this time that I started understanding how far medicine has gone that I didn't even know. I mean, I'm sitting talking to Dr. Driscoll the other day, and she's talking about a patch that they can put on my wound that will cultivate skin cells. This is amazing stuff to me. We're going to have to get together and talk about it. Well, I'll make a list of some of it and give it to you and see if you want to come on and talk about it. I mean, do you feel like you've been left behind, kind of?
Oh, yes. Yes. Even the treatment of infections, you know, there's things coming up every day that is new, and you think, oh, that's so far.
That's very cool. It's like living in a science fiction movie, man. I mean, seriously.
Yeah. Well, it is. It really is.
I appreciate you, man.
I'll tell you another thing that you need to do. You got to get somebody from the FBI to come over and talk. There's some really surveillance stuff now is scary.
There was a story I read the other day, real quickly here.
I mean, I know this doesn't have anything to do with me.
I understand, but there was a story. You saw what they're doing in China, in that if you want a cell phone, you got to load up your picture. Our federal government has started talking about that. That's for another show, though.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Yamauchi. Appreciate it. Terry Yamauchi here. Infectious Diseases on the Dave Elswick Show. Come back. We'll talk about things. And then Congressman Hill will join us from D.C. Second hour of a Wednesday show. We got a great show for you today, really do. Coming up at the bottom of the hour after our news, Congressman Hill is going to be on with us. We're going to talk to him, as well as at 4 o'clock, Joe and Duck will be here, and they're bringing in some special guests as well. And then 5 o'clock, Robert Steinbach is going to be on. Now, when Robert comes on, we're going to talk about what's going on with the impeachment again. Today they've had these, quote, Constitution, scholars on and saying whether what the Democrats are doing is, you know, indicative of an impeachment or not. And Turley is there from George Washington University, who is a real, you know, conservative libertarian. And he's giving a totally different feel on all of this than the other three, one from Harvard, trying to think one was, I think, from Penn State or something like that, and one was from another school. There's one of them that's up there, like, talking down their nose at everybody, which just drives me crazy when they start talking to somebody and saying that they're a constitutional scholar, you know, and they start talking to you because you're too stupid to even understand the intricacies of America's Constitution. Well, the Founding Fathers didn't believe that way, all right? People were standing out on the square and reading it to people because the people back then evidently could understand it, the average Joe. So I'm just saying, crazy to me that it's that way. Turley, you know, is up there. And by the way, was not a supporter of President Trump. He voted against him, he said. But has said that, this this is going to be the shortest impeachment in history. And it's the first with no crime. And he made that statement today. So a lot of people are testifying today and asking questions and things of that nature. So, you know, with that in mind, let's hear what some things are being said today. Congressman Doug Collins, I've been featuring him quite often, Republican from Georgia, I think the 9th District there. And, you know, he read Jerry Nadler's past comments about impeachment, made some very important parts, made some important points. And let's listen to that, cut number two.
But, you know, what I also see here is quotes like this. There must never be a narrowly voted impeachment or an impeachment supported by one of our major political parties or imposed by another. Such an impeachment will produce divisiveness, bitterness in politics for years to come and will call into question the very legitimacy of our political institutions. The American people are watching. They will not forget. You have the votes. You may have the muscle, but you do not have the legitimacy of a national consensus or of a constitutional imperative. The partisan coup d'etat will go down in infamy in the history of the nation. How about this one? I think the key point is that the Republicans are still running a railroad job with no attempt at fair procedure. And today, when the Democrats offered amendments, offered motions in committee to say we should first discuss and adopt standards so that we know we're dealing with standards for impeachment that was voted down or ruled out of order. When we say the important thing is to start looking at the question before we simply have a vote with no inquiry first, that was voted down and ruled out of order. So frankly, the whole question of what material should be released and what is secondary, but that's all we discussed. The essential question, and here it is, which is to set up a fair process as to whether the country put this country through an impeachment proceeding. That was ruled out of order. The Republicans refused to let us discuss it. Those were all Chairman Nadler before he was chairman.
He went over before he was chairman. Yeah, that's the stuff that he was saying. And then he went on to say why this was proceeding. And here he is again, cut one.
This is sad. So what do we have here today? You know what I'm thinking? I looked at this, and what is interesting is there's two things that have become very clear. This impeachment is not really about facts. If it was, I believe the other committees would have sent over recommendations for impeachment. Now they're putting it on this committee because if it goes badly, I guess they want to blame Adam Schiff, Hissey, and others want to blame this committee for it going bad. But they're already drafting articles. Don't be fooled. They're already getting ready for this. We've already went after this with the Ukraine after numerous failings of Mueller, Cohen, annulments, the list goes on. But the American people are foxy failing to see us legislate. But if you want to know what's really driving this, there's two things. It's called the clock and the calendar. The clock and the calendar. Most people in life, if you want to know what they truly value, you look at their checkbook and their calendar. You know what they value. That's what this committee values. Time. They want to do it before the end of the year. Why? Because the chairman said it just a second ago. Because we're scared of the elections next year. We're scared of the elections that we'll lose again. So we've got to do this now. The clock and the calendar are what's driving impeachment, not the facts. When we understand this, that's what the witnesses here will say today.
There you go. All right. And he's right. I mean, I can take you back and play Congressman Green from Houston, where he said, we got to impeach the president now because he'll win re-election. I mean, just saying. That's what it's all about. They had Green on Fox yesterday. And, again, it's hard for me to watch the guy. I got to look away from the TV because I keep seeing the Geico caveman. But, yeah, he was just went on and on about it. It was pretty interesting what he had to say. And it all came down to you don't want to have anybody, you know, lose out, so to speak, how that is concerned.
Fletcher Laurie, bumper to bumper.
All right. I've been looking forward to having him on. This is going to be fun. He's here early, man. There's fresh coffee if you want some. They'll take care of you. All right. Senator Cotton speaking out today about the whole impeachment. I think that he was on our early morning show and talked about what was going on about removing the president in the Senate. This is a long cut, but you need to listen to it. It's got a lot of good things into it. Let's hear what he has to say, cut four.
Good morning, Senator Tom Cotton. How are you?
Good morning, Hugh. It's great to be on with you.
Thank
you. And hope you and all of your listeners have got off to a good start to the very short Christmas season this year. I'm sure all your shopping is already done.
It's all done. It's all cyber shopping. Tom Cotton, I've known you a very long time, since I think you were a ranger on deployment in Iraq. Did you ever in your imagination see yourself as a juror in an impeachment trial of a president?
No, regrettably, Hugh, it looks like I may be that. The Democrats in the House have continued with their obsession about impeachment, and I gather they're probably going to pass articles of impeachment sometime this month unless they come to their senses, in which case they'll come to the Senate for a trial. I don't think anyone expects that there will be 67 votes to remove the president from office. In fact, I think there'll probably be more Democratic votes against impeachment in both the House and the Senate than there are Republican votes in favor of it. The really regrettable thing, too, is that the people's business is not being done. In the meantime, Hugh, we haven't passed a budget to fund our government, especially our military. We haven't passed the annual defense bill that's been passed 58 consecutive years. We haven't passed the Mexico-Canada agreement, which has been waiting for a year now for all of our farmers and foresters and ranchers and manufacturers. So there's a lot of work that is not getting done while Nancy Pelosi's House is obsessed with impeaching the president, as they have been since January 20th, 2017.
Now, Senator, have two-part question. Have you discussed the trial and its logistics and procedures in the conference, and whether or not you've discussed it, what do you think is your job as an individual juror?
Hugh, we've had some preliminary discussions about the basic rules of impeachment proceedings in the Senate. You know, we have Senate impeachment rules, even though impeachments of presidents are pretty uncommon. There have been many more impeachments of lower court judges in particular, so there are a set of standing rules that kind of give some right and left boundaries. But those rules are very, very minimal, Hugh. Impeachment trials really depend on what majority of the Senate can vote on. You know, in 1998, there was a unanimous resolution to structure the Clinton impeachment trial. I'm not sure that that's going to be the case in today's Senate. But if they send articles of impeachment over here, I think we'll take a careful look at them. From what I've read in the news, some of them might deserve immediate dismissal. You know, if, for instance, they say that the president or his aides litigating their constitutional prerogatives in court is de facto evidence of obstruction of justice. But I also believe the president wants to actually put on a genuine defense of his actions. That's what I've heard from him, you know, in his public statements and from my conversations with people in the White House, that he views the Senate as a place where he can actually get a fair proceeding to present the evidence and arguments in his defense, unlike Star Chamber in the House.
Some of your colleagues, including Senator Klobuchar and Senator Warren, have already declared their belief in the president's guilt. Ought they to recuse themselves from this proceeding?
Well, Hugh, as you know, if you go read Alexander Hamilton's Federalist Papers on impeachment, it's not exactly like a criminal case. They're not looking for impartial jurors. And our founding fathers knew that when they made the Senate the trial for impeachment, that it already might have people who are partisans in one way or another for the accused individual. So it's not surprising.
Yeah, Federalist 65 is the one No one ever reads. It's going to be a brawl.
Yeah.
Do you anticipate the right? I've seen you ask difficult questions of important people before. Do you anticipate asking a question from the chair of any witnesses that might be called?
Hugh, you have to remember that the impeachment trial is also most senators' view of purgatory or even hell. They have to sit silently in their chair on the Senate floor, and they never get to make a speech at all. So any questions have to be submitted in writing during an impeachment trial.
Do you think that among others, the whistleblower and Hunter Biden ought to be called, and Adam Schiff? Three questions: whistleblower, Hunter Biden, Adam Schiff. Should they be fact witnesses?
I think there's a strong case they should be fact witnesses in the Senate, Hugh. Now, ultimately, I think that decision will be up to the president's lawyers in the impeachment trial. But whatever you think about Joe Biden and Hunter Biden, you cannot dispute, unless you are the most kind of in-the-bag partisan for not just the Biden family and the Democrats, but the kind of Beltway establishment, that there was a gross conflict of interest in Hunter Biden being on the board of a Ukrainian oligarch's company while Joe Biden was the point man for U.S. policy. Perhaps there's nothing there, but it certainly is worth reviewing, and it certainly goes to the president's thinking whenever he's made statements that he wanted Burisma investigated.
Quick question. Has the political article by Ken Vogel from January 11, 2017 been retracted in any way, shape, or form to your knowledge about Ukrainian meddling in our election?
No, to my knowledge, Politico has not retracted that article or issued any corrections of it, nor has Mr. Vogel, who's gone on to work for the New York Times, which must have confidence in his reporting background.
It's going to be fascinating. How long do you think it will last, Senator Cotton? 30 seconds.
We don't really know, Hugh. It'll be up to whatever 51 senators vote on in terms of a process, and also to what the president's lawyers want to call as witness.
All right. Now, I got to tell you, after listening to that today, I am going to read Federalist 65. I'm going to pull it, print it, and read it, because evidently that gets into a lot of the weeds, so to speak, on impeachment. I'll read it. You don't worry about it. And I'll have Robert read it. And one day we'll sit and talk about it. Maybe Monday. That would be a good topic for Monday. And talk about it. And discuss it so that you can hear it all here on the Dave Elswick Show. Cotton went on to talk about how the voting would probably go. Here's cut number five.
Did you ever in your imagination see yourself as a juror in an impeachment trial of a president?
No, regrettably, Hugh. It looks like I may be that. The Democrats in the House have continued with their obsession about impeachment. I gather they're probably going to pass articles of impeachment sometime this month unless they come to their senses, in which case they'll come to the Senate for a trial. I don't think anyone expects that there will be 67 votes to remove the president from office. In fact, I think there'll probably be more Democratic votes against impeachment in both the House and the Senate than there are Republican votes in favor of it.
That was just highlighting from the five-minute piece that we just played. But the bottom line is, he's exactly right. I don't see any Republicans voting against the president. You go, well, what about Mitt Romney? Mitt Romney has been so wobbly on this president. Well, here's what he had to say, cut number six.
I saw no evidence from our intelligence community, nor from the representatives today from the Department of State, that there is any evidence of any kind that suggests that Ukraine interfered in our elections. We have ample evidence that Russia interfered in our elections.
There you go. All right. He's not worried about the Ukraine. No, he is worried about Russia. And he's not going to find the president guilty of anything that the Democrats are talking about. When we come back, Kevin McCarthy, the minority leader in the House, talks about Speaker Pelosi. Speaker Pelosi said one thing about impeachment when we started the new, Congress. Now she's whistling a completely different tune. We'll get to that when we come back on the Dave Elswick Show. Okay, let's get back. And McCarthy, the minority leader, of course, Kevin McCarthy, Republican California, was talking about Speaker Pelosi and reminding everybody what she had to say about impeachment early on and what she's got to say about it now and how it's all changed. Here's cut eight.
Adam Schiff, just standing here today, I watched you ask him a question about whether we should move forward with impeachment. It's interesting because Adam has a hard time with the truth. Because Adam said just a few days ago, in his words, he is going to send the president back to the golden throne he came from. Adam had made his mind up long before. He just didn't have the proof, so he had to write his own story. If you read his report, he only picks what he wants, and he still does not have anything overwhelming, compelling, or bipartisan. But that does not stop him from continuing to make items up. If we watch where it's going to go tomorrow, you heard from Doug Collins. Doug Collins is the ranking member in that committee. The committee chairman is a congressman named Nadler. Nadler had to campaign for this position. It was a competitive race. So Nadler wanted to lay out to all of America, and especially to his colleagues, of why they should vote for him to become chairman. He said he would be the strongest member to lead a potential impeachment. This was the creation of their majority. That was their goal. And he himself admitted last year, if you're serious about removing a president from office, what you're really doing is overturning the results of the last election. Many of the Democrats have been very honest about this. from Al Green, who put the impeachment before, long before they were even in the majority, before any Mueller report came forward. Two-thirds of the Judiciary Committee on the Democratic side had voted for those. They're concerned that if they do not impeach this president, they can't beat him in an election. This is exactly what Alexander Hamilton warned us about. And unfortunately, we now have a majority solely devised on one goal. But that one goal harms the entire nation.
There you go. By the way, you said Hamilton in that, because Hamilton wrote Federalist Paper number 65, which gets into in depth about impeachment, how it should run, things of that nature. I just had that pulled down, by the way, from the Yale Law School is where we got it at. And I'm going to read it. And Robert, I'm going to give him a copy of it for him to read it as well. And what he will do is we'll talk about it on Monday and we'll get into it. And what were some of the things that were in it that we should be taking not any issue with, but should understand. Like, let me just... You got to understand the way that they wrote back then. They wrote, you know, in English that they understood back then. See, the delicacy and magnitude of a trust which so deeply concerns the political reputation and existence of every man engaged in the administration of public affairs speak for themselves. The difficulty of placing it rightly in a government resting entirely on the basis of periodic elections will as readily be perceived when it is considered that the most conspicuous characters in it will, from that circumstance, be too often the leaders or the tools of the most cunning or the most numerous faction, and on this account can hardly be expected to possess the requisite neutrality towards those whose conduct may be the subject of scrutiny. All right, as we do every week, every Wednesday for a half hour, joining us from Washington, D.C. is Congressman French Hill. And Congressman, how are you today?
Hey, Dave, great to be with you.
Good to have you here. Let's start off, instead of going with impeachment first, because I've been speaking about that for the last half hour, let's talk about the president and NATO, because that's really important. He's had a legitimate impact on NATO. Now, there's some little bit of pushback going on right now. They were talking behind his back and all of that kind of stuff. He's not a real happy camper with Trudeau or Macron or any of those guys. So your take on it.
Well, I don't think the French have been happy since they stopped using French as the diplomatic language to use English. I mean, come on. We have a complicated relationship with France, and I really think listeners ought to put that in perspective. I mean, you could go back and take Trump's name out of that paragraph and insert Jack Kennedy's name or Ronald Reagan's name or Dwight Eisenhower's name. But at the end of the day, France is our longest ally, left over from Revolutionary War days. They are a friend of the United States. But France is always trying to assert its leadership in Europe. And you saw that with the interchange, I think, between Macron and Trump. So it's not new. It's a standard tense part of the relationship that we have with our oldest ally.
Well, I loved it just because, you know, I'm going to send the president my great French jokes that I have. My favorite one is to say if there's a World War III, the loser has to keep France. But
well, don't forget, I've got to deal with this in my own name. I mean, during the when President Bush was arguing with France about Iraq, I mean, we had Freedom Fries, and I changed my name for a while to Freedom Hill instead of French Hill.
That's so right. Well, that only makes sense to me. I mean, it really
absolutely
does.
So, well, listen, it's a serious issue, and
yes,
I think Donald Trump should be commended for continuing to press the Europeans to pay more for their own defense and let the American taxpayers begin to slowly reduce their contribution to that financially, not manpower, not strategy, as President Bush would say. But in the dollar category, Germany and France and the United Kingdom and others need to step up among the allies. And just since President Trump began pressing, we've gone from, I think, around three countries that met the 2% GDP participation level up to nine. So President Trump's pressing for more financial support is good, and he's done that in the right way. And let me tell you, every president since Jack Kennedy has asked for the exact same thing.
Yeah. Now, you brought up something, or Steve did, to me that I did not know, and that NATO is going to uptick their spending from some of these companies, countries. However, they agreed, NATO agreed Thursday to reduce the United States contribution. I hadn't seen anything about that in the press.
Yeah, and this is exactly what, as you know, the president has made this point all over the world as it relates to our military and our military support of our alliances. We're delighted to be a strong partner. We're delighted to be their nuclear umbrella. We're delighted to be a strategic partner in planning and executing and operating. But we want more financial support. And in one of those things, just in this most recent meeting, the basing expenses of the you can think of it as of the headquarters budget is now being covered more by the European countries, and that's good. And I think it makes NATO stronger that the 29 countries have more skin in the game and play the role. You can't replace American space, cyber, air power, and of course, most importantly, the nuclear deterrent, but you can certainly have more of a sense of partnership in the financial budget. And listen, by saying this, I'm not taking anything away from the men and women who wear the uniform of those countries and fight alongside Americans around the world. I mean, just last week, President Macron was involved in a funeral for 13 French forces from being killed down in Mali, down in Africa, is a part of the fight against Boko and ISIS down there in Africa. So we're proud of the men and women who wear the uniform that share the NATO patch.
Well, as we look at making the other countries pay their fair share, something that everybody needs to understand is that America still bears the burden of more troops than anybody else in NATO.
Sure. And we're the largest economy by far, but I think where President Reagan and President Kennedy before him and now President Trump realizes is that you have Germany, which is a large economy, it has a budget surplus, claims that they'll hit the 2% of defense budgeting of GDP by 2031, and that's...
Well, that's BS.
It is. I mean, that's where the president's coming from. He's saying, look, this is a rich, smart, well-organized partner in Europe that's right on the front lines, and they ought to be doing more sooner. And most of the gains we've made have been a modest uptick in for Canada's contribution and through our newest allies in Central and Eastern Europe, people who were on the front lines of the Cold War for 70 years, those are the ones most sensitive to increasing their defense spending.
Last question about NATO, and let's talk about Germany, where we have a lot of troops at over in Europe. And I came across a story, I think it was Tuesday, that some of our bases in Germany have to use Russian natural gas. Is that true? They're being forced to use Russian natural gas? Do you know?
I don't know about being forced, and I don't know that that's the if what size or scope of our base supply is from it. But the general answer to your question is that yes, Germany has, as you know, been a constant voice. This also goes back to the Reagan administration. President Reagan pressed Chancellor Kohl and his predecessor to not connect with Russia and become dependent on Russian natural gas, and they pursued it. And as you know, President Trump raised that with Mrs. Merkel last summer at the meeting in Helsinki when he was discussing the same topic.
What is her answer to doing this with your sworn enemy when you can take it from your sworn friend, the United States?
Yeah, well, a couple of things. One, that when relations are good, the gas price from Russia, obviously, is cheaper. That's point one. Point two, I think Europeans, even during the Cold War, felt that if they had more integration, there'd be less chance of war breaking out. We know over history that that's really not ended up being the case when you get down to the brass tacks. So this is why, beginning in the 80s, the administrations, all the administrations, have urged Europe to diversify. But we haven't been able to put that at warp speed, really, until the 2013 to 2019 period. Why? Well, fracking and directional drilling in America mm-hmm. have made America the largest producer of natural gas and now the largest crude oil exporter in the world. So that price is now lower. We have transportation facilities for liquefied natural gas on the east, west, and Gulf Coast, and we can get that gas over to the Adriatic or the Baltic quicker and faster. So it's more reliable now than ever, and that's why I think President Trump continues to press that. We're not asking him to stop using Russian gas every single day of the week, but think about the blackmail potential of that in any kind of crisis situation.
You better believe it. All right, Congressman, we're going to take a quick break. We come back. Let's talk about that horrifying word, impeachment, here on the Dave Elswick Show. All right, we move into the last part of this half hour. Congressman French Hill is our guest from Washington, D.C. We're going to move into talking about impeachment. Got to talk about it. It's a big deal that's going on in the chambers right now. And, Congressman, your thought, first of all, of that first report that came out from Schiff.
Well, I have both the Schiff report and the Republican minority report on my desk to take home and plow through. That'll be about 400 pages of reading. But when you look at the summary that's been released by the Intelligence Committee, you know, there was no fact case built in the basement under Schiff's leadership that leads to high crimes and misdemeanors, bribery or treason that deserves impeachment. You know, I've said since September 25th, if you want to conduct foreign policy oversight in the House Foreign Affairs Committee, because people differ on how to conduct foreign affairs between the executive branch and a foreign country, you know, go for it. That's fair game. But to allege that there's an impeachable offense and start an impeachment inquiry, I just thought was over the top. Not to mention that it was not done in conjunction with the more balanced and fair approach taken by Republicans with Bill Clinton or Democrats with Richard Nixon. And now we've started this, quote, new phase where the report's presented to Judiciary Committee, and I actually don't know what they're going to do. I mean, they say they don't have any new material. They didn't really present a fact case that leads to a firm bipartisan consensus and conclusion. So I guess it's going to be an echo chamber in Jerry Nadler's world. So I think we just have to wait and see what they do. It's a mystery.
Well, Jim Jordan said today, it was Congressman Collins from Georgia mm-hmm. who said that confuse yourself. They're already drawing up articles of impeachment from the judiciary. Why have hearings if you're that you're that convinced that you need to impeach the man? And number two, why does Schiff say we've got concrete, ironclad evidence and then says, I don't know if we'll impeach him or not?
Well, this is when you're watching a 1968 episode of Mission Impossible and there's some authoritarian dictatorship that Jim and the gang are going to break into, it's a show trial. It's, this is all for television. And when you don't have facts on your side. All you have is drama and breathless reporting by the national media. So to me, it's disappointing. It's turned off a lot of Americans. It's more of the what's expected now out of Washington, D.C. What we ought to be doing is having a serious agreement on an appropriations bill, get the National Defense Authorization bill passed. We've passed it 58 years in a row bipartisanly, and we still don't have it across the goal line. It should have been passed last summer, and we're still arguing about that. And we, of course, USMCA, the United States-Mexican Trade Agreement, which needs to be finished for benefiting Americans mightily, because that's our most important trading partners in the whole world, certainly to Arkansas.
Let me jump in and ask, what have you heard about that? The last time I had you on, you said that the speaker had said they were going to take it up, but you weren't sure if that was true or not.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because I visited with Vice President Pence today and Kevin McCarthy, a couple of different circumstances, and really both implied to me that it was soon, that they were hearing now that Mrs. Pelosi had gotten whatever she wanted added, and that the Mexicans and the Canadians were okay on something regarding biologic pharmaceuticals between the countries, or some issue that was she was still hung up on. So we got to keep our fingers crossed, but we may well get this done before Christmas, and that would be a big win for President Trump's efforts on trade. It would be a big win for American manufacturers and American farmers.
Any worries in your mind after what happened with Trudeau at NATO and the talking behind the president's back, as he called him two-faced, that this will cause any problems?
You know, I really don't. I mean, Trudeau's lucky to have gotten reelected a few weeks ago, and that was a long, tough campaign for him. Again, I think people need to – people spend too much time talking about what they think about each other in public these days, whether it's on social media or – in public. Let's just get to work. You know, it's the old adage that my dad and my first bosses drilled into my head. You don't have to like the people you work with, but you've got to get along with them and produce a product. And so I believe the Canadians are satisfied with this deal. They've approved it in their parliamentary system. Prime Minister Trudeau's spoken out in favor of it. So let's push it over the goal line.
Yeah, and so it's up to the Speaker of the House now.
It is, and she's going to need something positive to talk about before Christmas, instead of her continuing efforts to do nothing to help the American people on health care, do nothing to help our men and women in uniform, and obviously not get our most recent, most important trade deal across the floor. So hopefully she'll do that, and that would be – I would consider that a victory, and I'd be willing to thank her for her diligent effort to get it passed. I mean, she's – you know, 6 or 7 months later than I would be, but that's her business.
Well, it's like President Reagan said, doesn't matter who gets all the glory as long as you can get it done.
Yeah, and that's important here, and it's important to my folks. But in the meantime, we're just eaten up in the Capitol building with this show trial going on with Jerry Nadler, we're not only violating every one of Jerry Nadler's policy positions and work in the Judiciary Committee in 1998 when Bill Clinton was under the same circumstances, but we're violating Speaker Pelosi's own guiding principles of spring 2019. We should not use impeachment. It's too divisive. It hurts our country. And that we should only do it if it's a strong, ironclad fact case and it's bipartisan. And so none of those premises are present here. So this is why I can't answer your question where she goes or what she does with it.
Yeah.
So I can't even speculate as to where. My view has been, since September 25th, she's caved, train's left the station. 17 of the 24 Democrats on the House Judiciary Committee voted for Al Green's impeachment resolution of a year or two ago.
Well, Nadler said make him chairman, and the best reason was he's the guy who could get an impeachment done.
Yeah, this was. Think about this is during the organizational meetings for this Congress. And when was that? That was, you know, last winter. I mean, it's a pre-cooked deal. And I think that's why the Americans are focused on the highest real wage growth in over a decade, while they're focused on low unemployment, while they're focused on a record Black Friday and a record Cyber Monday. And while they want the economy to keep growing and more opportunities for our kids, and they just think what goes on in D.C. is nonsense. That's what I hear when I'm at home. And even so many people are saying, why can't you all get things done? And if we were focused on communicating about the work we try to do instead of it being dominated by the Adam Schiff show, I think Americans would have more confidence in the direction of the country and what's going on.
That's all the time we have, Congressman. We do this once a week. It's always a good visit with you, and we appreciate you bringing us up to date on issues that are affecting Americans and Arkansans here back home.
Dave, it's always a pleasure to be with you. Look forward to seeing you soon, and enjoy this run-up to that happiest time of year.
I got you. Thank you so much. We'll talk to you later. All right, Congressman French Hill here on the Dave Elswick Show. All right, we got news coming up top of the hour, and when we come back, we've got special guests in the studio with Joe and Duck that you won't want to miss. That's all coming your way. In the final hour today, I'll be talking to Robert Steinbach. We'll talk about what's been going on in Washington, D.C. today as Congressman French Hill talks about the show trial that is occurring in Washington, D.C., and about all of the constitutional scholars that appeared. And we're talking, by the way, the constitutional scholar couldn't remember Yale or Harvard. It was Stanford that one of them came from as well. So let's get to the news, and then when we get back, we'll have more for you here on the Dave Elswick Show. Show. We move into the 4 o'clock hour. Some of you are done for the day, you lucky dogs. I'm not going to be too envious, but yeah, you're ready to get done for today. Your Tuesday's just about finished. Before we get into talking with Joe and Duck and their special guests today, I wanted to thank Duck on the air personally. for bagging a dough for me over the weekend.
It was a 7-point.
Oh, 7-point, yeah.
It was. And, it was about like this.
Yeah. Anyway, he bagged a deer for me, and they cut it up, put it in the bag for me, and it is now over at the buck stops here, being ground up as we speak. Thank you very much.
It'll make good hamburger meat.
Well, I'm just telling you, look, the way I am right now, I couldn't be in a stand.
Hey, I only can hunt one. I got one that I can ride the Polaris up to and step out of Polaris into the stand.
There you go.
It's about...
Is that the one that's got the elevator?
No, it's... Well, I wish it would have. I would have to crawl up them four steps. Yeah. It's about 4 foot up off the ground, but...
Is that where you shot the deer from?
Yep.
Cool.
Hey, I got a good comfortable chair in there, too.
Well, that's where you got to be. You got to take a nap once in a while.
Well, especially when it's a rainy day.
Yeah.
That tin roof up there.
Yeah, listen to that.
Shut the windows and turn the heater wide open.
No, my goodness.
I got a 100-pound propane bottle behind it.
I know. We've talked about this before.
There ain't no use being rough out there.
You don't want to be uncomfortable while you're, you know, out there to get your deer. I agree with that.
I might get cold while I'm sleeping or something.
All right. All right. If you're watching on Facebook, do we have the picture up there now? We got the picture of Joe with George Bush that he had his picture taken with him, and he got his award for. Tell everybody exactly what the award was for.
It was for performance Wicks, Babcock's Media for Driving Performance Award and Customer Service.
Okay. And yep. I can tell you about, look, Joe has been my car's technician, at least at his garage, 20 years.
Yes, sir. About that.
I mean.
Real close.
Mike Willingham told me, he said, I was looking for a mechanic at that time, we said.
Yeah.
And he says, I know the guy you need to go to, and I've been going to you ever since.
I appreciate that, Dave, very much. Thank
great
you.
Great service and most honest guy I know.
Having me on your show for 15 or 16, 17 years, however long it's been. Thank you very much.
It took me 2 years to get you to do it.
I know. I'm slow to move.
You know?
Hey, that ain't nothing. He come pick me up one day and said, come on, we're going to lunch.
Yeah, you went to my show.
Yeah, I said, where are we at? He said, we're at the radio. We're going to go to lunch after that.
Yeah. It's the only way I can get him to go.
That's
so
right.
I just had to go over and just kidnap him. You know?
Then when he got to talk about trucks a few times on the radio, he was history with it.
So the picture that's up there won that in Las Vegas for that award, and Fletcher Lord sitting here with us. Thank you for the picture very much, and thank you for the opportunity to be able to do that. Without you guys, it would never happen.
We were delighted to have somebody that was our customer that won a national award. I mean, it wasn't some local two-bit deal. This was nationally recognized as one of the best operators in the country.
Well, thank you very much.
All right, Jerry is here. Everybody knows Jerry. He's been on the show enough that I just say Jerry, everybody knows who he is. Who's our special guest?
We have Fletcher Lord.
Okay.
Fletcher is our chairman of the board, and that means the boss.
Or as I say, the big enchilada, right?
Exactly. You can put it either way. Boss, a.k.a. the boss, but he is chairman of the board for Replacement Parts Incorporated, which means... Parent company for Crow Burling Game Company, Parts Warehouse, CDP, Car Dealer Parts.
Okay.
And he can correct me if I got that wrong.
You got it all right.
Okay, you got it right.
Good.
So now when you have the board meetings, are you like Fred Flintstone? Do you put that hat on?
No.
To sit up at the front?
Our board meetings are more casual than that.
Yeah, the Grand Poopah. As Fred Flintstone was called. It's a pleasure to have you here, sir.
Thank you. Glad
it really, really is. Why don't you, 100 years in business, all right, what kind of responsibility do you feel when you're made the chairman of a board of a company with 100 years in its past, and you're looking forward to the next 100 years?
Well, you know, this didn't happen overnight. It wasn't like throwing a switch and it's been going to happen for 20 or 30 years. We could see it coming, and I was hopeful that I might still be around when that thing happened. Quite frankly, it was kind of funny because as we got closer and closer to it, we had no idea what to do to celebrate 100th anniversary. We had all kinds of suggestions and nothing kind of caught fire. But as it turned out, between our vendors and our customers and our employees and stuff, we had a really, really grand 100-year party that everybody was really proud of.
Very cool. Very cool. Was. Now, it's good that you didn't put me in charge. It would involve cakes and women. I'm just saying. That seems like the only thing to do in 100 years. What about the next 100 years? Do you think about that?
All the time. The problem I've got is that I ain't going to be here for that next 100-year party.
At least you think so.
Well, I'm pretty positive, I can tell you that. My family is continuing. The fourth generation of our business is continuing. And they've been in the business for 13 or 14 years, and they've played a lot of different roles and are assuming a leadership role, but they've got a lot of help behind them. And the era, and I've been around 52 years, and the parts business has a life of its own, and you can decide you want to be whatever you want to be, but the industry is going to pretty much tell you how you're going to go right. about doing it. The best thing you can do is try to be pretty good at it instead of try to change the world. And that's kind of what we do, and I think that we got a lot of things in front of us, but they will incrementally change things, but we'll deal with it.
All right, so I got some really good questions. I really do, because tell us about, you're talking about the industry leading the way, you know, telling you how you have to do what you're going to do. Technology is the same thing. Autonomous vehicles. Total change in the way we have cars. You got the major car builders that are trying to tell Congress that they need to pass laws that say that when the car needs to be fixed and it drives itself to be fixed, it goes back to the dealership. I mean, you guys got a lot of battles to fight here in the future, don't you?
We do. But from the very beginning, we've got a unique kind of distribution system in the auto parts business. And because it's got an extra step in the distribution, everybody's always thought, we're just going to take those guys out because they're just too expensive. You can't do that. The trouble is that it's the only way the system works. And you can eliminate the income off of it, but you can't eliminate the job. So ultimately, Joe expects to call on the phone and 30 minutes later have what he needs arriving at his door. And that's not going to happen any other way except that you've got to have that multi-step distribution that gets it to you every day.
Okay. So let's talk a little bit about that. How does your thoughts change, Joe, as you look forward? I think it's over the next 5 to 10 years that we're going to see these seminal changes going on in this business.
Well, you know, I was talking to Tom Singleton the other day, and he showed me a video about a man that had a car wreck and how insurance companies drive business back to the manufacturer or to their specific collision centers.
Correct.
And that video, I'm sure you've seen it. That video is just a self-telling portrait of what's going
to
happen.
What's to come.
Because they're going to drive it that way, and they're going to cut us little guys out of the loop, like Duck and me, if we were in the collision business. I think you're going to see that move over to the repair business, too. If you're broke down on the side of the road, it's going to set a code. They're going to call them and say, hey, we've scheduled an appointment for you. We've already sent a tow truck to pick you up and take you to such and such. Are you objectional to that? I don't think they're going to have a choice. You ought to have a choice to say, no, I'm going to get my own tow truck and do my own thing.
Well, that's like my new truck. I got a OnStar sent me a message on the dash, said, hey, you got a recall on the rear seat belts in your truck.
Yeah, and they'll make you an appointment, too, won't they?
They would if I'd have told them to, but, yep. You know.
And that's one of the battles that we're fighting in Washington. It's a constant battle. I think it's the reason that we won't lose the battle, at least in the shorter term, is because it's such a consumer-driven issue. Everybody knows that the most efficient way to get your car worked on is close to you, locally.
Yes,
having
sir.
Somebody that you can
and someone that
on.
You know.
Someone
that's
you
right.
have a relationship
yes.
with.
Yes,
and
absolutely.
If you've got to drive to the edge of town and wait in line for an hour and make an appointment to be there and then turn around and have to go back at the end of the day and pick your car up, and then they call you and say, well, it's not going to be ready because we've overbooked, that's an uphill fight for the consumer to accept that. And it may happen, but as long as there is an option and they have the option to trade someplace else, I feel pretty confident that at least for the foreseeable future, our business will stay somewhat like it is.
Well, I'm certainly hoping that, and I just, you know, for the average guy driving a car, you know, sooner or later, and I know this from being in business for a long time, and you do too, that people are creatures of habit. They get in the habit of going somewhere, doing this, that.
They're not going to change.
They're not going to change.
Unless they get mad.
Unless they're driven.
Yeah.
Like herded like cows in one direction, then that herd's bigger going down that fork of the road, and the other fork gets less and less cows. So.
Yes.
I think the new millennium generation is going to be a bigger challenge. They just simply look at the, they haven't had the experience that our generation had. When I first got in this business, there was a service station on every single corner of the town. They all stocked parts, and they all worked on cars.
That's right.
And if we didn't go out and call on people that ran service stations, we wouldn't even be in business.
Yeah.
They don't even exist anymore. It's a C station that serves chicken.
You know? Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. They don't have nothing there.
But the market has evolved, and the business has gone to the Joe Sharps in the world, where rather than having a one-bay shop, and they work on cars sometimes, pump a lot of gas, now it's a full-time business that's got multiple bays and lots of expertise and a long history of being in the business. So it's evolving, and it continues to evolve. And I can't bring the service station back.
No.
It's just
the way it is.
It's the way it is.
The gas jockey ain't coming back.
No. Mm-mm. I can remember my dad had a Redbird station. It was a full service. That's all he had was full service. He cleaned the windshields. He washed. I mean, he checked air in the tires. And
that was my really first good paying job. I was making $3 an hour.
Wait, I got cheated. I had to work.
You know, wash the windshields. Check the oil and all of that.
We need some retro stations where there actually are full service.
You know, I think if somebody did
be
that,
a big hit. I believe
the exact same thing. Yeah. I think the same thing would happen. Let's get our first break in. We've got the chairman of the board here. And we're going to pepper him with questions on the Dave Elswick Show. Keep in mind, coming up in the next hour, Robert Steinbach will be here. Monday, Robert will be here. And, of course, he's a law professor over at UALR, a conservative. And he and I are going to talk about Federalist Paper 65, written by Alexander Hamilton, which deals with impeachment. And it's very interesting. And we'll be talking about that. We'll talk about what the founders thought about impeachment. It's pretty interesting. Of course, the Democrats think that the Constitution is a living, breathing document. Last time I looked, it was written on paper that was dead. So I know that it means what it meant back then, and that's the people that we should look at to figure out what we should be doing today. And what we should be doing today is not what's going on in the judiciary. Let's just put it that way.
Yep.
All right. Just keep that in mind.
So, Dave, when we were standing over and, you know, waiting on you for it to come on,
Mr. Just shut up and let you get on?
Well, no, Mr. Now, see, Dave, you didn't have to go that far.
Yeah, well, I just know you.
You know, Mr. Fletcher was talking, and we got ready to walk over here, and he was talking about the mule ride, you know, and, you know, nobody wants to go hit your mules up to go to town, and, you know, and basically that's
nobody,
how all this got
you.
Started.
Explain what you're talking about.
Well, you know, back in them days, you want to go to town, you went out and hitched your two mules up and got your wagon. It didn't have no cover on it. It had a wooden seat in it, and you rode.
We're talking 100 years ago.
Yeah, you rode 20 or 30 miles of town, got you a little bit of what you needed, and then you rode 20 or 30 miles back on it. And today, you know, like Mr. Fletcher said, nobody wants to go out there and hitch mules up.
And I can understand that. My father, when his family moved to West Virginia, they went in a Conestoga wagon. That's how they got there. I remember him sitting down talking to me one time and just saying, you
was
know,
it
I can't
the Sportster
it.
Version?
Yeah, it was.
Family version.
It was an ST. That's what it was.
Yeah, ton of horsepower.
When I first started traveling, calling on company stores and getting out in the country for the first time, really, there was mules on every farm. Mules everywhere. And I swear to God, I don't know the last time when I seen a mule.
My neighbor right around the corner has four.
How long did it take to change?
It just changed over time.
Well, I know that, but I mean, it didn't take a long time.
When I first started traveling, everybody in the state had a party line. You know, it was things have changed a lot.
And my household had one of them. Get off the line!
Well, we used to measure prosperity by how many new TV antennas you could see popping up over.
And then it was, who had the color TV and had you been invited to come
That's
watch
exactly
it?
That's exactly right.
Well, there's a lot to be said about that. My dad, my old man, he had the first remote control TV anybody in town. Because he would say, get up and put it on channel whatever he wanted to watch. Yeah. And I was the remote.
Got up and did it.
And then you had a handful of aluminum foil, right?
Oh, yeah. He said, turn it this way. Now, hold it right there. I'm watching the news.
Yeah. Those were the days.
We didn't watch TV after 12 o'clock either, though, did we,
no,
Mr. Lowry?
You got your screen, whatever they call it, thing on the screen, the Star of a Spangled Banner.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess, you know, Mr. Lloyd, what I'm alluding
to. By the way, my name's Fletcher.
Okay. Fletcher, it doesn't take long for change to change. I mean, you're talking about mules on every farm. I bet you it wasn't that many years that those farmers said, you know what, this truck thing works pretty a whole lot better than the mule. I don't have to feed it like that.
Yep.
And I don't have to shovel it like that.
That's right.
So, you know, I'm happy to be able to get myself a truck. And a lot of and then Ford came along and made it, you know, reasonably priced so that the average Joe could buy a car. Things change fast.
Dave.
And they never stop changing.
Can you believe how many changes he's seen in it since he's, you know, been there 52 years, I think he said?
I can't hardly believe it.
I mean, you just go from here to where we are today. It's just unreal.
Well, that's always my dad. He used to say, I came in a covered wagon. You know, I saw the Model A. I bought a Model T. And he just went down the road, and he said, and then his thing was, and now I watch men go up in a rocket and come back in a rocket.
Go land and walk on the moon, turn around, come back home.
That was in 70 years. That's a short period of time when you're talking history. That's a short period of time.
Yeah, it is. You know, you talk about the evolution. Talk a little bit about what it consisted of to do a tune-up years ago and how many miles you got on each tune-up.
Not many.
About 12,000 miles, wasn't it?
If you were lucky.
And he had a set of points and condenser, plug wires, distributor cap, rotor, spark plugs, coil. In today's world, you can do all that with parts you can hold in your hand.
When I first started getting inside parts stores, you know, I wanted to sell parts, but nobody would let me wait on them at all because they wanted an experienced parts guy to do it. And so they said, no, I'll wait on so-and-so. But it was amazing. Everybody that walked in the place wanted the same thing. They wanted points, plugs, condenser cap, rotor. They wanted about three different tailpipe numbers. I mean, it was a pretty dadgum easy business to be in, and prices didn't change much, and the parts didn't change much. And your average part was $10 or $12. Now you don't sell any of those, and the average part's $120.
Yeah.
And you don't turn them very fast, and you got a whole lot of different ones. So it's just a constant evolution, and it isn't going to stop changing.
No, it's not.
It changes every day.
You're talking about parts ordering. Your guy walk in and say, hey, I need such and such, such and such, talking to the counter guy. He go over and look it up in the book for a year, make him model, ask a few basic questions. Today's world is like me and Duck. We go over and sit down at a computer. Mm-hmm. We go to my place for parts, bumper to bumper, and we look up our own parts.
Yep.
Of course, your database, you know, transfers all the pertinent information, year, make, model, engine size, four-wheel drive, everything. So we don't have to enter all that. It's already done for us. But then we're just looking at the part we need, whether it's AC part or a tune-up part or spark plugs or wheel bearings or whatever. So
until you get to the bigger trucks.
Yeah. Well, then it's a different bird.
Yeah,
but what I was getting at is that the parts man doesn't exist anymore.
No.
Basically. Because he really only...
Well, he doesn't for you, but the vast majority of
the walk-in traffic still
well,
there.
Yeah.
You know, we like to measure our business by how many white trucks are in the parking lot.
Yeah.
All right. Let's take a break.
Okay.
We got to go to the news. We'll come back. We'll continue talking with Fletcher Lloyd. He is the chairman of the board for Bumper to Bumper. All right, we're back. Business later.
we were talking a little bit there about the evolution of things, and Fletcher was telling a story about the statewide phone number. Tell that story.
Well, when we first went into business, we were basically selling accessories for new cars because they were shipped in a box. And all the stuff like tops and seats and wheels and all that sort of thing you bought from a distributor, and it made it cheap to ship. Put them on a train that way. But we had a statewide phone number that was Maine 464. So if you were in El Dorado, you went and cranked your phone, and Mabel answered the phone. You said, Mabel, give me Maine 464 and a statewide number, called in Little Rock, and we put it on the train and got it to you the next day.
Yeah, no. I remember when you would pick up the phone and you would talk to the operator, and we didn't have three numbers to start off the phone with. It was like Empire 6525. And that's mm-hmm. how your numbers were. It was letters at the beginning.
Yeah, I remember when we was younger, ours was Roland, 629. That was the first phone number that I can ever remember we had.
Yeah.
And I thought, nowadays, it blow people's mind nowadays.
When I was growing up, I had a phone number. It was 35918, and it became Mohawk. And then
there you go, Mohawk.
Son moved back to Little Rock, when he was off in the NASCAR world, he moved back to Little Rock, got him a cell phone, and the last four digits were 5918.
That's interesting. Yeah. That's very cool.
Random.
Yeah. Well, you know, they say things make a circle. They make a loop, you know. 40 years ago when I started in this business, I was holding a light for the technicians. 40 years later, I'm still holding a light for the technicians. The only difference is they work for me now. Yes. But I'm still doing the same thing. I'm holding a light.
So. Yep.
That's the truth. I mean, it is the truth, but there's a lot of changes that are coming, I think, very quickly. We talk about it all the time, Joe, Duck, we talk yep. about it on the show all the time. Autonomous cars are one thing. How, you know, let's talk about that, Fletcher, about you got these parts stores. Is it going to become a thing of the past? I mean, because Shade Tree Mechanics are becoming a thing of the past.
Surprisingly, there's more things that Shade Tree Mechanics still do than you would think they can do.
Really? Yes, there is.
And it's remarkable because you can get on Google and just say, I want to replace headlight on my car, and it shows you exactly how to do it. And a lot of people are inclined to do that sort of thing. Now, when you raise the hood of the car and it's got all that cover underneath it and everything's under that pretty well eliminates most shade trees.
Well, yeah. What eliminates most shade tree is that $20,000 computer they got to have.
It is the diagnostic right. of what's wrong yeah. with it, not the actual
Precisely.
Repair. But
yeah. Precisely.
You know, you got to go back and remember that it's still in today's world, the cars are computer controlled, and the diagnosis is harder than the repair. That way you don't put parts on you don't need.
Well, you take a diesel truck now, and I'm talking about 18-wheeler running up down the road. I mean, you can't do nothing without that computer that we've got. Because it's got so much exhaust problems nowadays. I mean, you walk in the shop anytime, and you'll see one or two trucks sitting there with all the exhaust pulled off of it, getting it clean. That's just the part of the life. And if you read your service manual that you get with your vehicle on a diesel, like a diesel pickup, it's been big, bold letters in there. It tells you every 100,000 miles it needs to be pulled and burnt. But most people don't do it until they have trouble, and then
it's too late.
Yeah, then it's $5,000, $6,000, $7,000, $8,000.
You know, we were talking about evolution and the right to repair and all that, and I know that in 2021 there is a convention that's going to happen from bumper to bumper, and the Aftermarket Alliance are going to go to Washington, D.C. Would you talk a little bit about that, Fletcher?
Yeah, we've been to the Hill twice already. We started off with about 60 people that went and talked about this issue on the Hill with our Congress and our senators. And then this just last fall, we had about 250 people that were on the Hill. And in 2 years, we're taking 2,500 people at the same time to go to the Hill. Hope you're going to be
one of them.
That's the way it works, man.
And
they're signed up.
And the problem is that it's all about money. And there is only one of us from a business point of view, and there's lots and lots of money that comes through the OE channels.
Yes, sir.
And so it's really difficult for the number two financial backers of the U.S. centers are car dealerships.
Yeah.
Well, and so it's really difficult to battle that.
Yes, sir.
You really just can't. And the GM and Ford and Honda and those people, they really believe that data is something that they ought to keep.
Yes, sir.
They don't think it's the consumer's business at all. They think if they built a car, they ought to be entitled to keep it and control the business that it develops. But the consumer doesn't feel that way.
Well, once you buy the car, it's your car.
It should be.
That's correct. It's your car. It's your data.
Like that cell phone you're sitting beside you, and all the Facebook and all the data that they're capturing about you. And the world is a crazy place today.
Yes, sir.
Well, did you see on TV the other day where they buying these smart TVs with a camera on them?
Oh, yeah.
They told them to put tape over the camera.
Oh, yeah, because they can watch you.
Well, they say that people are hacking into them through your, and they're watching you, and they know when you leave to rob your house.
Really?
Yeah.
So they was.
So how long is it before they start hacking into your car?
They've already done
that. They've already done that, Dave.
I mean, I'm just saying.
They've already shut cars down.
If you're an assassin, that'd be a way to get rid of somebody, wouldn't it?
Yep.
Just saying.
We saw, you know, on the advisory council, they showed a video of an insurance investigator. And he does them for fatality wrecks and stuff, you know, car crashes, airbags deployed. He goes in there and he takes his laptop and he hooks into the SRS module, the supplemental restraint module, and downloads all the data. He can tell if you had your foot on the brake, how fast the car was, what steering angle it was at, when the collision occurred,
or whatever.
How much you weighed sitting in the seat, how quick the bag deployed, because it's based off weight. And when he got through that, he said, let me show you something else. He goes over and pulls out the info system with the GPS on it. He plugs into it. He said, I can tell you every picture on that guy's telephone. Yep. Anybody's ever been in his car and hooked to the Bluetooth, the Wi-Fi, or plugged it in and charged it.
It
downloads all their data off their phone into the car.
Precise.
Yeah, and that is just crazy, isn't it, Fletcher?
It is to me.
Well, that's like, you know, Dodge now, they went in there, they locked their computers where I can't get to them on the 2019s. For one reason, because they had one of their cars hacked, shut off running down the interstate, and a woman got run over. And so that's why
the ex-husband did that, but he was really smart.
No, that's what I'm saying. You know, it's getting to the point you'd be afraid that somebody's going to hack into yours for whatever reason. And, you know, I mean, there's people out there that just want to, you know, burn down the world.
Well, Dave, speaking of, you know, talking about the big trucks have had this for 15 years. They have a password in there. And if you don't know the password, you cannot get into the computer. I mean, I've got generic passwords where I can fudge and get around it and look at it. But like ABF, every one of theirs got a password in it. You cannot take an ABF truck and I cannot hook to it unless I got that password to open the computer up. If an 18-wheeler has a wreck, the first thing the insurance company wants me to do is pull the ECM off and put it in their hands. They don't want me to hook to it. They don't want me to look at it. Put it in their hands, and they take it off with them. Now, a lot of times they bring it back when they get through, and I have to put it back on the truck if it's total, but they walk off with that computer in their hand.
So how does all this affect, you know, bumper to bumper, Fletcher? I mean, the government controls a lot of things. There's a lot of regulations that you've got to deal with. And that drives your price as well, does it not?
Undoubtedly. Drives everybody's prices. But the problem that you've got is that not only are we accumulating this gigantic bureaucracy of data that is going to be dealt with, nobody knows what the outcome's going to be. It's the unintended consequences that turn out to be crazy.
Exactly.
That you hadn't planned for and didn't know they were happening. Now, it may be the big boys up in the ivory tower know exactly where they're going and probably do, but us everyday folks don't. But the problem that you've got with cars is that it's just in a constant state of flux all the time, because about 15% of everything you sell is going to be obsolete each year, meaning that 15% of the parts that come in on the front side are new, and 15% of the old ones are old that go away. So there's a constant change, and then it changes by car. For example, when I was growing up, Chevrolet, Ford, and Chrysler were 99% of what we sold, and now well over half the nameplates are foreign car. But is a foreign car because it was made in the United States, or is it not a foreign car? And so it gets very complicated. And we do a far better job in the old days of having coverage on everything that you could ask for than we do today, because it's so broad.
Much bigger,
Well, you can take two identical vehicles and stuff will be different on them. you know, I've got two City of Benton trucks that's got the serial numbers are one number apart, and they're both Freightliners, but they're different.
Well, this G5 thing that's coming along is going to change the planet in a big way.
Yes, sir.
And nobody knows what the consequences of all that are.
And nobody knows where it's going.
No.
G6.
You know, I was talking to, I do Snap-on Corporation. I do front-end machines for them and help test them when they come out with a new unit. And I was talking to one of the techs there, and he said that Snap-on is encrypting all their data. And he said, I'll give you an example. He said, you don't want this hooked to your Wi-Fi here or your social media. And I said, no, I don't. They know Snap-on owns Mitchell, so, hey, ain't no big deal. Yeah. I just don't want it on there because that puts their data acceptable. Anybody's vehicle I've worked on is in their system. He said, we're encrypting ours. He said, and I said, what's up with that? And he said, same reason you don't want it. It's ours. It's our job to protect your information. He said, I'll give you an example. He said, I had a tree fall on my house. Called my own insurance agent. He said, report it, and they're going to come out and look at it and do an estimate. And he said, 20 minutes after I hung up the phone, my phone is going off, going crazy, because they sold that information, and now I've got all these roofers calling me wanting to come out and do an estimate. And so, you know, if you look at that nobody's information is private anymore, and it's not. If you give anybody anything, somebody else has got access to it. And that's really and truly that you know, there's going to have to be a stop of that somewhere, I think.
There's no privacy anymore.
No, there's not.
No. Doesn't exist anymore.
But you've got the driverless car, which is going to be a reality. There's no question
about it. That's coming.
And this G5 with all of this technology is going to usher that in much quicker than most people anticipate. Electric vehicle is going to be a phenomenon. It's not going to replace the combustion engine as we know it. And then there's all kinds of other technologies coming along. But even if you talk about the systems that might be replaced as a result of a new technology, there'll still be other things in the car which always have got to have maintenance.
Yes.
You got to stop the car. You probably want to have it cool. You probably want to have lights on it.
And you have
probably,
maintenance items.
You've got all those sort of things that you've got to do. But one of the things that's really a problem are that you don't really get the implications of is the unintended consequences. I read something not long ago that basically said there won't be any used cars in this country when the autonomous vehicle starts to run. It's going to run 24 hours a day. So Joe's car, when he drives to work, will drive off from his house and go pick somebody else that's going to work all day.
Be like ride
sharing. That's correct.
And so at the end of the day, when normally I would have driven a car 4 or 5 years and gotten 150,000 miles on it, that car is going to have 700,000 miles on it and going to be in a junkyard a long time ago.
Yeah.
And there won't be any used cars.
They'll wear them out and then dispose of them.
That's exactly.
Recycle them.
They'll wear them out, and wherever they stop at, they have somebody come along, pick them up, put it in the truck, drive off, and get the next one.
Well, either that or they'll ship it across the ocean to some third world country and say, well, if it's broke, you guys fix it.
These are going to be so well worn from the kind of miles they have on them. And nobody's ever really planned for that.
I mean,
right now, we've got cars that are the average vehicle's 11, 12 years old.
Yeah, and they'll run 250,000, 300,000 miles.
Absolutely. My car's got 120,000 miles on it, and there's nothing the matter with it. It's fine.
I got a parts delivery truck that's got 637,000 miles on it.
Yeah, before I dropped the new motor in mine that I got in it, I had 267,000 miles on my car.
The motor in the red truck, the old one I got, it had 581,000 when it finally
gave up the gas?
Yep.
All right. Got to get a break in, guys. We got a break, and then we'll come back, finish up a very interesting conversation here in just a moment with the chairman of the board of Bumper to Bumper. We want to thank Fletcher for coming in today. He's chairman of the board, Bumper to Bumper, and kind of walk us through, you know, where are you going at this time? When you started, how long did it take you to know that, you know, you guys are like the 800-pound gorilla for a lot of people.
It's a homegrown
company. Not hardly. We look around us and see 800-pound gorillas. We're not one of them. But as I said earlier, the business has a mind of its own, and you just sort of try to be as good as you can at doing whatever the industry's doing. When we first started, we started in 1919, and it was 1928 before my grandfather bought his first branch in El Dorado, Arkansas. And then subsequently, he bought or opened or bought probably as many as 20 stores over about a 10-year period of time. And then the government came along. We're talking about government involvement. And basically, they said that if you're not doing about 40% of your business with people besides your own stores, you're not eligible for discounts. So everybody went in the warehouse business and started putting stores in all over. So by the time I came along, it was 7 warehouse distributors in Little Rock, and every one of them had 5 or 6 to 14 stores.
Yeah.
And there wasn't any point in trying to put one out of business because the warehouse is going to just put another one right back in behind him.
Right.
And if the warehouse got in trouble, the manufacturer's just going to put one right back in behind them. So at that point in time, you just did the best you could to run a parts store and make some money and make a living for your folks, and that's what you did. And then a few years later, all those guys said, hey, what are you going to do with me now? Because I'm ready to retire. So all those parts stores that had sprung up all over where one by one started going away. And when I first got in the business, everybody in the business looked the same. I mean, we had parts and kind of a lot of the same parts, the same brands. And we were 2,000, 3,000-foot buildings, and nobody was retail and yada, yada, yada. And today you got AutoZone, you got Advance, you got O'Reilly's, you got every kind of national retailer there is. The dynamics have changed dramatically, and you don't get to vote. You just play on the field you find yourself on and do your best. And yeah. The whole secret to our business always has been is as long as we can surround ourselves with the kind of people that like and are good at running parts stores, we're going to be just fine.
Do you sit and look out on the business landscape and try to identify areas that you want to get into that maybe others are pulling out of?
Well, we are pretty multifaceted compared to some people in the parts business. We're in the heavy-duty business, we're in the paint business, we're in the tool and equipment business, and we're in the auto parts store business. And we have a sprinkling of retail business that we do. It's not our major forte, but people walk in the door and want to buy things from us, and we've got conveniently attractive parts stores for them to trade in. And so we do a little bit of it all. And I think we're probably already there as far as looking for different things to be involved with. And we do a big business in the farm community. We sell lots of hydraulics and things that yep. that typical parts stores don't sell. You know, we just kind of do it all. And our motto, and has been forever, is that we just like to try to continue to get better at what we do, whether it's our locations are improved or whether we get a person in place that we really wanted to have, or whether we do a better job managing our inventories, or new marketing programs. I mean, it's just your head's down. It's all in every day. It's fun, but it's not easy or relaxing. It's just it's all in. It's every day all in.
All right, final question for me, and I think it is a good one. You're a homegrown company, family owned and operated
in Arkansas.
In Arkansas, all right. You have locations outside of Arkansas.
We do.
How many states are you in now?
Well, our territory is from about Kansas City to New Orleans, and from Beaumont, Texas, over the other side of Mississippi.
Okay.
But we've grown those businesses primarily through acquisition. We were talking about guys waiting to retire.
Yes, sir.
Well, that gives us opportunities for us to buy a business from which it's a business much like ours. And he wakes up at me 65 years old and says, come talk to me about my business. So that's, in addition to opening our own stores for years, then we kind of went into the acquisition business, and we bought groups of stores, and that's how we got the territory that we're in. We're in 7 states.
All right. I got 90 seconds. How big does Bumper to Bumper want to be?
Yeah, well, Bumper to Bumper is a national flag that we fly.
Okay.
Our Crow Burlingame Company and our parts stores, we're about 170 stores strong and about 150 independent bumper-to-bumper stores strong. we don't have any raging desire to be 2,000 stores. I think that that world already got taken up by other people. But we're constantly looking for opportunities to grow. And they come up all the time.
There you go.
Thank you, Mr. Fuller, for showing up and,
number one man,
and visiting with us.
You hear, he goes to bed at night thinking these things. I'm just saying.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for coming on. Jerry, thank you. Joe, thank you. And thank you, Duck. We appreciate you. All right. Robert Steinbach's next. We're going to talk about some of those liberal Supreme Court justices that they, the legal beagles that came from Stanford and stuff, and they don't know anything except that they have been with Democrats all the time. We got more to come here on the Dave Ellswick Show. Show, final hour of a Wednesday show. And you know about Wednesday. Wednesday is hump day, middle of the week day, over the hill day, closer to Friday than we were on Monday. And we're going to finish it up today with Robert Steinbach, who is, of course, a legal beagle. He is a professor of law over at UALR, Bowen School of Law. His opinions are his and his alone, although they should be the universities and school, though, but they're his and his alone and do not necessarily reflect those of the university or the school of law. Now, I was going to get into impeachment again, but before we do that, as you know, this show prides itself on talking about local politics as well. One thing that I have always said is that when it comes to the primary, that should be left between the contestants, so to speak, those who are running for office. Up there around the Jonesboro area, you got Cooper and you've got Sullivan that are running to be senators in that area, and they're running against each other on the Republican ticket during the primary. With that said, I'm getting word, as Robert's getting word, that the governor is getting involved. And I think the governor should sit down and be quiet when it comes to the primary. I don't even hardly say anything during primaries. The only reason I've said anything about, you know, Cooper and Dan Sullivan is that Cooper has proven himself not to be a Republican.
Cooper has not only proven himself not to be a Republican, Cooper has demonstrated that he lies. Cooper ran on a platform of voting no for Obamacare, and when presented the first opportunity to vote for Obamacare, he voted for Obamacare.
Mm-hmm.
So the question, Dave, I have for you is, do you want to vote for a conservative, and do you want to vote for someone who tells you the truth? Here's the irony. When Dan Sullivan ran against Cooper last time in the primary, he lost because Cooper came out and said, I'm voting against Obamacare.
That's exactly right.
And Dan said,
I need to
look it over.
Yeah, I want to think about it.
I need to do an analysis because I didn't get enough details yet. So he was the reason thinker. And while we had already understood that Obamacare was bad news, Dan didn't disagree. He just said, I want to think about it. We said, well, I guess, you know, Cooper's going to be strongly anti-Obamacare. And so conservatives went with Cooper.
Anti-expansion.
That's right. Well, anti-Medicare, Medicare expansion. Medicaid. I think Medicaid, right? Yeah. Which is Obamacare.
Yeah.
That's Obamacare. So we were against Obamacare. We thought we were going with a candidate who was against Obamacare. We got hoodwinked by Cooper, Cooper's lies, because he was pro-Obamacare. Dan did his analysis. You know, Dan has been in the medical business, the medical care business, the hospital-type business. And he said, I wanted to do my analysis. Sorry. He did his analysis. And you know what he did? He came out against Obamacare.
Yeah, he did.
He made the right call every step of the way. And I wonder if this dispute has something to do with the fact that the governor supported Obamacare.
Yeah, he supported expansion.
Right.
That's what he supported. Well, he was handed expansion, and he took it, and instead of killing it, continued with it.
Right.
And there's still a lot of, you know, hard feelings about that, and right. There's been a lot of politicians who spent a lot of time fighting against that. Notwithstanding that, okay, here's the key. The governor should stay out of the primary, period. He shouldn't be involved in any primary in the state of Arkansas. That's just the way it should be.
Right, right.
Well, I don't disagree with that. I don't disagree with that. But I guess my quibble is a little bit stronger, which is if you're going to get involved on the right side.
Well, yeah, and this is the guy that, you know, killed the Stand Your Ground legislation in the last
Chuck,
time.
Chuck, what's his name? John Cooper. I know a guy named
John
Chuck.
Cooper did the exact
John
same
Cooper
thing.
John Cooper was the deciding vote
in
committee against Stand Your Ground. Now, if you're a conservative, if you believe in gun rights, that must mean that you believe that if someone is attacking you,
you got to run away.
Well, that's the.
I mean, that's the bottom line.
Right, but what I'm saying is, if you're a conservative, you believe you don't have to run away, and
yeah,
that's all
that's
Stand
right.
Your Ground
that's what we
says.
Do
says you don't have to tuck your tail in and run away. If someone's attacking you, you're entitled to stand your ground. God bless America. Those two statements go side by side. Stand your ground and God bless America. Those are of equivalent strength. We are Americans, Dave. We don't turn and run when the harm comes towards us. I originally, as you may recall, as my accent might disclose, am from New York. And you know what the New York's finest did and New York's bravest? That's what we call the police and the firefighters. When those buildings were coming down, they ran into the buildings.
That's right.
Not out of the buildings, Dave. They ran into the buildings. And Stand Your Ground says if you're an American and some thug is coming up against you and trying to attack you, trying to attack your family, you don't need to look to the left and look to the right and tuck your tail between your legs to see if there is a hovel that you can hide in. You can stand your ground. God bless America.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, that's the way it should be. You walk in my house, I guarantee you they'll carry you out.
That's right. That's right.
I've always believed that. I think that's a primary belief of most people who live in America.
That's it. It is a
unless
foundational
concept. Unless you're invited
concept.
In, stay out. That's the bottom line. And the governor should stay out of primary races. That's just, he'll not come on my show and talk about that. I think he should come on and explain himself about that. But I don't understand. Well, I do understand. I mean, I'm not dumb. I understand he wants as many votes as he can get from politicians who will vote the way he wants them to vote. Mm-hmm. I understand that. He's got an idea of where he wants the state to go, and he wants everybody on board with him. Problem is, not every place he wants to go is the place we want to arrive.
Well, I could never vote for a candidate who is opposed to Stand Your Ground because I have, by the way, Dave, I've said it before in your show, I'm going to say it again. I've voted for Democrats.
You're right.
Conservative Democrats. But I voted for, and by the way, yes, they're going to have some policies undoubtedly that I don't like. It's been years, been many years since I voted for a Democrat, but I don't rule out that possibility. But what I will never vote for, and what I have never voted for, Dave, is a leftist.
Mm-hmm.
And the notion that you can't stand your ground, that's a leftist notion.
Well, that's sure not, to me, a Republican notion.
No, not at all. And so if you have a candidate who's opposed to stand your ground, that's a leftist position, plain and simple.
Yeah, that I mean, is pure leftism. One of the principles of the Republican Party of Arkansas is the personal right to own and bear arms, which extrapolated out means that you got the right to self-defense, period. Period.
I don't know how else. I don't know how else to break it down. I don't know how else to break. A bunch of bureau hacks, a bunch of anti-gun folks. Listen, and there are nice people that are also amongst them who are anti-gun rights, but they're wrong. And I am not anti. Dave, I said, I think when I guest hosted your show a couple of weeks ago, I said on the air that I am that I have established or determined the Steinbuck scorecard. Now, between me and you and all of your thousands of listeners, I assure you, it's not scientific. But the scorecard is rather simple. Are you pro-Second Amendment? Are you pro-freedom? Are you pro-small government? I'm not saying no government.
And are you pro-life?
And do you believe in life? If those are the factors on which I will judge candidates. Chuck, I keep doing it, I apologize. John Cooper fails on guns, and John Cooper fails on small government. He's failed two of the four measures that we've just discussed. That fails the Steinbuck scorecard. Sorry, you're out. And, of course, Dan Sullivan passes all of the elements of the
absolutely.
Steinbeck scorecard.
Absolutely. There's no doubt about that.
I'm just a little bit perplexed.
Okay, so let me ask this question.
Sir.
All right. Have you heard?
Yes, sir.
Because this I have not heard. You tell me, have you heard, has the governor been up in that area actively campaigning for John Cooper?
I don't know. I got the sort of the same notice, so to speak, that you got regarding the governor's activity regarding John Cooper. And it surprised me.
It surprises me, too,
right.
Because I'm pretty sure I've heard the governor say that he does not get involved.
Apparently he said something like, I generally don't, but I'm getting involved on this one. That's a mistake. That's a mistake.
No. Now you're making, yeah. So we're going to have to – I will go out and start talking to the people that I know.
Right.
And we will get some yays or nay behind it.
Well, look, at this point, given what's happened, I'm going to have to go up to Jonesboro and help Dan maybe with some rallies and that type of thing. Because Dan Sullivan is the conservative choice.
Well, I was going to go up whether the governor got involved or not.
Well, I was certainly open to it, but now I think it's a done deal.
Okay.
I think it's a done deal.
Good.
Because this is, there's no way that, look, Bob Ballinger is probably going to be the next attorney general. Mm-hmm. Bob Ballinger was the sponsor of Stand Your Ground. Stand Your Ground is one of the most basic conservative values in
self-defense.
Self-defense.
God-given self-defense.
That's it. You don't have that
shouldn't
right.
Shouldn't have to have it voted
Dave,
on.
You don't have that
it's
right.
It's a given.
You don't have that right from government. Government didn't give it to you.
I know.
You inherently have that right.
That's correct.
And government has taken away that right from you, and people like Bob Ballinger, Dan Sullivan, Kim Hammer, what's the chair of the Judiciary Committee, whose name I know?
Clark.
Clark, thank you. Sorry, Senator Clark. We know him well.
Yeah.
Senator Clark, Mark Johnson, mm-hmm. there are several others that I could rattle off if I wasn't so terrible with names. All these folks.
Garner.
We know all these folks, and we know that they are conservative on guns, and that's the only position a Republican should be taking. You want to be a Democrat? Listen, I've said it once. I've said it 1,000 times on your show, Dave. I've met Joyce Elliott many times.
Yeah, nice lady.
Very nice lady. Charismatic.
Yeah.
Smart.
Yep.
And wrong on almost every issue.
Yep.
And so I would never vote for her. She's against Stand Your Ground. Why? Not because she's illegitimate, because she's a leftist. So I say to her, Joyce, you're a wonderful person, and it's pleasant to be around you, but you're wrong on the issues. And I understand why you're wrong on the issues, because you're a Democrat. That's okay. That's your right. And by the way, I respect your right. I disagree with your substance. I respect your right.
But we'll do everything to beat you.
Absolutely.
So that you can't put any of your, you know, issues
exactly
into play.
But when you get a wolf dressed up in sheep's clothing coming into your barn saying, I'm a conservative, and then that wolf votes against Stand Your Ground, that's worse.
Starts eating your flock.
That's it. That's what I mean. Well, Dave, what do you think voting against Stand Your Ground is? It is eating your flock.
Yeah.
Because you're out there on the street one day. God forbid, I hope it never happens to you. But it takes once. You're out in the street one day, and some thug comes up to you. And you've got to look to the left and look to the right and determine if there's a hovel you can run into before you defend yourself. You know what? You're dead on the ground, Dave.
All right. We got a break. We'll do that. We'll come back with more. Robert Steinbach is here, if you haven't figured it out.
Have you heard me?
Here on the Dave Elswick Show. It's weird. All right, back. And Robert Steinbach is here. Remember, he is a legal professor at the Bowen School of Law. His opinions are his and his alone, and do not necessarily reflect.
Mm-hmm.
I was going to say respect. Reflect.
Either
the school
one
of law or the university.
Oh, and not either one there.
Yeah, I gotcha. So right. We're going to continue our discussion here. But I think it should be kind of a party mantra that the governor doesn't get involved in primaries. Now, general election, different story. He should be out, you know, beating the bushes, banging the drum, shooting up flares for every Republican candidate.
That's
what he should. But the people in the party should pick the people that are going to run in the positions for the party, not the governor.
Well, I agree with that, Dave, but I got to tell you, your argument, a solid one as it is a procedural argument. That is, the governor should not be intervening as a matter of process when we have two competing Republicans. But here's what I have to say. We don't have two competing Republicans, Dave. On that, you're mistaken. I tease you a little bit, obviously, because you have Dan Sullivan, a Republican, running against Chuck Cooper. I did it again. Running against John Cooper. By the way, there's a brilliant attorney in D.C. named Chuck Cooper. So that's why I keep doing that. But John Cooper ain't that guy.
No. I agree with that.
Dan Sullivan, a conservative, is running against John Cooper, a liberal. And it's one thing not to intervene procedurally for the reasons that you well articulated. It's another thing, however, that when one of the candidates in the Republican primary is a Republican in name only. Nobody should be backing that candidate, Dave. And so I'm troubled by the substantive decision to back that candidate.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong. You were up with me at the Capitol during the last general session.
Yes, sir.
Wasn't Cooper's only bill the one dealing with barbers?
Not only was Cooper's only bill that I recall the one dealing with barbers, he pulled it. And you had him on your show, Dave.
Yeah, I did.
And Paul was interviewing him. And Paul did a good job, by the way, interviewing him. And Paul said, well, what's the deal with the bill? And he said, well, it's not going to go anywhere. And Paul said, well, why not? And he said, well, we couldn't get this one group to agree. And I thought to myself, Dave, he's a state senator. If they don't agree, and you think it's right, Write the darn law!
Yeah, write the law, and then, and this is something that doesn't happen a lot of times, find the nearest TV station and say, I've got something to tell you about. And say it, and let them carry the story out there and let the people know about it. The way you generate the buzz necessary to get a piece of legislation through.
Right. Right.
He didn't do that.
No.
I don't think he was interested in doing that.
But people like Bob Ballinger, I mentioned earlier, Kim Hammer. Actually, here's a fun, it's funny, I mentioned all of these names before. Kim Hammer, Bob Ballinger, and Dan Sullivan, all original co-sponsors of the Dave Elswick free speech bill.
Yep.
Was John Cooper a co-sponsor of that bill?
No.
No. No, because he was nowhere to be found. He's busy dealing with barbers. Can we? And by the way, his bill on the barbers was not a bill that was reducing regulation.
No.
He was replacing one regulatory scheme with a different regulatory scheme. It was one bureaucracy instead of another bureaucracy. It was a bill that went nowhere.
I agree. All right, we got news. We got to get to that. We're going to give you traffic as well, weather. You get all of that. Keep in mind that we will be back for another 25 minutes here on the Dave Elswick Show on 101.1 FM, The Answer. We just got some information and more about John Cooper. You know, John Cooper, like I, as we've been saying, has carried on like a full-fledged liberal Democrat than like a conservative Republican or even a moderate Republican. And what did you find out about taxes?
He was, he was in the bottom quarter of the conduit ratings.
Right.
Which puts him amongst the Democrats, of course. On tax legislation, 6 out of 8 Democrats have a more conservative voting record than John Cooper.
Wow.
6 out of 8 Democrats have a more conservative voting record on tax legislation than John Cooper does.
Okay. As far as all of the information we gave you at the beginning of the show about how John Cooper voted about ACA and how John Cooper voted on Stand Your Ground, all that is well documented. If you just go on Google.
Oh, yeah.
Just go on Google and start typing in John Cooper, Medicaid expansion, and read what he was saying during his run for the Senate, and then read what he did after he was elected to the Senate, and it's two distinct different stories.
Has he ever explained himself on that?
No.
Has he ever been called to task on that personally?
Directly? He kind of takes the tact, I feel, when you talk to him. He looks at you and I expect him to say, if you press him really, really hard, that he'll say, well, you don't understand. It's so complex that, and we get so much information more than you do, that we have to vote against what you want done. You've heard that a million times, all right? It happens.
Dave, I may not be the smartest apple in the barrel, but if John Cooper tells me I don't understand something, I'm looking over my shoulder because something's wrong.
Yeah, well, I don't disagree with that.
Right.
I'm just saying.
I know it. I'm just saying.
There's others that have said that as well down in the Garland County area. I forget what the lady's name is, but she's basically said the same. You just don't understand. We get so much more information on this complex subject, and so we can make a much better decision than you can. That is telling your constituent they're stupid.
That's right.
I mean, that's just a flowery way of saying, I know more than you do, period. You know? Not saying that some of the people might know more than I do about something, but I know that this, for a fact, is that ACA has been an unmitigated disaster as far as I'm concerned, as far as how much money we are paying to make sure that people have, quote, health insurance and treatment in our hospitals around Arkansas.
Not only that, Dave, we were told, and you and I and many others knew it was hogwash, but we were told, listen, the Obamacare is going to go on forever. You better get on that gravy train now, or you ain't getting your fill of it. And sure enough, President Trump got elected, and he started rolling back Obamacare. And so right now, it's not the panacea that all those folks that were saying it would always be is. It turned out not to work. And so where are they now? Where are they now when they were saying, don't worry, the gravy train is going to continue forever? There is no gravy train. And that's why those who opposed Obamacare from the beginning had always said, listen, it's like a drug dealer. The first one's free, Dave. The first Oxycontin is free, but the next one's $10.
Yeah.
So good luck.
Then after that, maybe 20.
That's right.
Depends on how much it costs us, because we're going to pass the costs on to you.
That's exactly right. And now, the first one was free on Obamacare, and now it ain't. And it's going to cost this state, it would have cost this state an enormous amount of money.
And here, let me tell you the other reason that we stayed with it. And it's the one. It was the argument that I made from the very beginning when the Republicans were saying, hey, look, we're going to do Obamacare differently. I said, let's look at what you're saying. Who has the final say on this?
Right.
And they would say the government. And I would say that it doesn't matter what you think. It's what they think.
Right.
It's what they will allow you to do. And do you think they're going to allow you to do what you're saying that you're going to do? And right. The answer to that is no.
No.
Now, here is the problem.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to end up doing what the Democrats want you to do. You're mm-hmm. going to get mm-hmm. the Affordable Care Act into law here in the state of Arkansas. You're going to tie people to that law. And when it comes time when you can't afford it and you got to go back to the voters to tell them you're not going to be able to supply it to them anymore, how are you going to explain that to them?
Mm-hmm.
And here's the problem. They don't. They try to keep figuring out ways to keep it in place because they know they've got the dookie end of the stick now. They played right into the hands of the Democrats.
Absolutely.
They played right into their hands.
And now that Trump has been president and started rolling back the Obamacare nightmare, everyone knows it's not the great deal any longer. So
well,
not only does
Trump know, not only do Republicans know, but there's all these people standing on a stage that are wanting to be the Democratic contender for the presidency that say it's not working.
Right.
And they want to expand it even more.
Right.
So.
Right.
They want Medicare for all.
Right. Oh, yeah.
Single payer.
Oh, that's all Obamacare. That's Obamacare Plus.
It was supposed to be what it led to. I'm trying to think.
Of course.
Who was the guy from Nevada that was the
Harry Reid.
Harry Reid, Senate leader. He was quoted as saying, we wanted single-payer insurance, but we knew the American people wouldn't buy it.
Right.
All right. Now, so they went as far as they figured they could go.
Right.
But now they're pushing single-payer insurance.
It's so remarkable, Dave, that in today's day and age, every time we see government having complete control over something, that's what single-payer is. Everybody gets paid by one source, the government.
You don't have any
you have
insurance
no choice.
That you buy out
You have
there.
No choice. Tell me, when you would go to the DMV, because the DMV was the only game in town for license plates,
mm-hmm.
did you have to wait online? Could you go somewhere else? No! You had to go to the DMV. And that's why you had to wait on a long line. But if you wanted to go to Dillard's, or you wanted to go to JCPenney, or you wanted to go to Sears, whatever the store was, if one Target, Walmart, if one of them is not doing you right, you go to another one. Every time we see a lack of competition, we see a decrease in quality. Every single time, Dave. The Soviets, the communists, they said, we will centrally plan. We will centrally control.
The British said the same thing.
Right. And when they centrally, you might think, well, is it efficient to have, you know, I don't know, 8-10 car manufacturers that we have that supply the United States? I'm talking foreign and American. Maybe it's more, a dozen, whatever it may be. You might say, well, look at all that duplication of efforts. But then look at the Soviets. Look at the Czechs. Look at the Yugoslavians. You remember the Yugo?
Yep.
Did you drive a Yugo?
Nope.
Folks, the Yugo was a car that essentially you take a giant wind-up key and you stick it in the back of it to twist the little spring to make it go.
And it was about as safe as a empty Coke can.
That's right. And why? Because in communist countries, the government said, hey, don't have all this competition. That's just inefficient. We're going to do it for you. We know better. We'll take care of you.
Mm-hmm.
You ever see movies of people that lived in the communist East Europe and in the Soviet Union? It's all gray. Hey, it's filmed in color, but it's all gray. They had to wait online for food. They were lucky if they had a car. Generally, they did not. Why? Because the government's going to take care of you. Trust us. We'll take care of you. So here's my question. Do you want John Cooper making your life decisions, or do you want to make the decisions for yourself? Because if you want to make the decisions for yourself, you're going to vote for Dan Sullivan. If you want John Cooper and other leftists telling you, you don't need a gun, you don't need competitive health insurance, you don't need to eat steak, you don't need to have a 13-ounce cup of Coke at the Quickie Mart.
That's Bloomberg.
I know. They're all the leftists. These are all the leftists, Dave. They all are the same. They want to tell you how to live your life.
Yeah. You can't get a 32-ounce soda. However, you can buy two 16-ounce.
That's right. But they want to tell you how to live your life. And John Cooper is one of those people.
All right. Let's break. Final break, and then we'll have our final segment with Robert Steinbach here on the Dave Elswick Show. I had to reach over. I want to play a piece of audio here.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm looking for it. It's from today. And talking about what is going on in the impeachment. And where is it? I have it here somewhere. I hate this when I just remembered that I had something. They've been trying, the Democrats are trying the best they can to move the needle. And here's the problem. They can't get the needle to move because they have such a weak case. In fact, they have no case.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we were just listening a few moments ago to Nadler reading his closing statement today.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, this stuff drives me crazy when they write up 12-page closing statements
right.
and opening statements
right.
and all the rest. Just shut up, all
right? Right.
All you're doing is blowing hot air to try to get camera time.
That's right.
That is all you're doing to try to get maybe one or two more people to vote for you when you run for re-election. But the bottom line is Nadler sat there and said, if the president did what they said he did.
Right.
I mean, he must, am I wrong in that he must have said if 12 times?
Minimum.
And this coming from a man who's the head of the judiciary, who heard from the man who was the head of the intelligence committee, who said they had lock, you know, stop hardcore evidence against the president. But still said, I don't know if we should impeach him or not. Sounds like to me just a whole bunch of hooey, and I didn't ask the congressman today. I will send Steve Smith, his handler, a note asking how much money has now been wasted on this impeachment effort after we'd already wasted $25 million on the Russian boondoggle. It's got to be more than that one.
I don't know if it's more or not, but the broader issue that you aptly raised, Dave, is that the Democrats are running a relay race. And they thought they were going to cross the finish line with the Russian story, and then Mueller got up there and imploded. And so they said, oh, my gosh, what are we going to do? And now they're looking for bones. Now they're looking for scraps. They're picking it up off the floor. They got nothing. It's really remarkable. You don't have to like what the president says. You don't have to like what the president does.
You don't have to like his policies. That's why we have elections.
And you don't have to like him as a person either. But none of those reasons are impeachable. And ultimately, if you boil down their complaints, that's what they are. We don't like what he said. We don't like what he does. We don't like who he is. That's not impeachable.
Yeah.
But they're going to impeach him, meaning they're going to vote to send it over to the Senate.
Yeah, I agree with that.
And the Senate's going to acquit him.
Yes, they are.
And it's going to hurt the Democrats.
It will.
Yep.
There's no doubt in my mind that it's going to. And that's the point. I had a piece of audio. I can't find it right now.
Mm-hmm.
That said, and I believe that it was Doug Collins from Georgia, Congressman Collins, saying, what's driving the Democrats crazy right now is they can't move the needle. Now, what he's talking about is they're watching their internal polling.
Right.
They're keeping an eye on it. And it's not moving in their favor.
Oh, it's moving the wrong direction.
Yeah, it's going the opposite direction.
It's moving in the wrong direction.
That's why you're hearing so many of the Democrats that are in solidly hot purple districts literally pleading with them to back off of this, and they'd like to do that censor thing.
Right.
You know, just censor the president and then move on.
Right.
You know? But I think Pelosi, Nadler, and Schiff all know now they're in too deep.
It's sort of like being pot committed in poker, right? I put in so much money in the pot, even though I don't know and don't think I'm going to win the hand, for a few more dollars, I get to find out maybe I do. And they're kind of pot committed.
Then they are.
Can I just mention as an aside?
Sure.
I always thought Nadler looked ridiculous with that huge chair sitting behind him. And I figured, oh, well, that's a chair for the chairman. Schiff.
Yeah. No, Schiff.
Nadler doesn't have that chair.
No.
So did Schiff opt to get that ridiculous chair that he looks like a 6-year-old sitting in?
No, I don't think he opted into it. I just think he is a 6-year-old.
He looks like a kid sitting in an adult's chair.
Yeah.
And Nadler doesn't
have that. Lily Tomlin.
Right. That's exactly what I was thinking. Looks like Lily Tomlin, who was a comedian who did a stage act in which she had this huge rocking chair so that she could play a kid.
Yes.
And that's what Schiff looks like in that big-backed chair of his. And Nadler doesn't have that.
That gives him gravitas.
I think it gives him the opposite.
I agree. He thinks it does.
Someone said send Schiff a picture of Nadler sitting in an ordinary chair and tell him, hey, you don't need a king's throne.
Just remember that to get the chairmanship of the Judiciary Committee, Nadler ran on this specific issue. He said, you put me in charge of the judiciary. I'm the best man to get the impeachment through.
I worked for a guy 20 years ago, and he was testifying before the House Judiciary, and Nadler was questioning him. And I didn't think he did a very effective job.
How many years ago?
Something like 20 years ago.
See, Nadler's been there too long.
Oh, he's been there forever. He's been there forever. And he was questioning him. And I remember when, after it was over, I said, and I didn't know who Nadler was even. I mean, I knew he was a congressman. He was sitting on the dais. But I didn't know anything about him. And I said, who's that guy and what was up with him? And my then boss essentially said he's no one to worry about. I suspect the same assessment. He has passed. My boss has passed many, many years ago. But I suspect he would have made the same assessment today.
All right. With that said, final statement.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, Harris dropped out of the race.
Who?
Yeah. All right. She dropped out of the race. Cory Booker said this.
Mm-hmm.
We're spiraling towards a debate stage that could have six people with no diversity whatsoever. And my answer to that is anybody of any color or ethnicity could have been running.
Well, not only that.
But they've not been able to win.
I guess women are not part of diversity. What is his definition even of diversity?
But I'm just saying.
Right. And
how ridiculous to say what he said.
Did he not know that President Obama was black or
that
is black?
That don't matter.
Does he not? He was
that
not
don't
aware
matter.
Of
I'm just telling
right.
you.
Okay. Okay.
We're talking about the debate stage.
So
now.
His complaint about the debate stage is that his fellow Democrats aren't voting for him and other people of color.
That's exactly right.
Well,
the party that says they're party of diversity.
Maybe they're the racists. The Democrats like to call everybody else racist. Maybe they're
I've
the racists.
I've always said when you're screaming at people and telling them they're this and that and you're hearing it from Hillary or hearing it from a lot of those libs, it's projection.
Yeah.
Because they are exactly what they say they hate. Oh, did you hear Hillary was on the Howard Stern show today?
No.
Yeah, and she,
seriously?
Yeah, seriously.
Really?
And she told him she wasn't a lesbian.
Okay.
She told him, I like boys.
Okay.
That was the big moment.
That's the big reveal?
That was the big reveal.
All right.
She says she didn't have to worry about dates. I've seen her pictures. I think she had to worry about dates.
I think she was an attractive woman when she was younger.
We'll have a disagreement on
there
that.
There you go.
But she did. She said, nope, I'm heterosexual. I am not. Now, she didn't say it that way, but
she said,
I like boys, all not
right.
girls. That's what she said. It's pretty amazing that she went on. How low have you gone when you go on Howard Stern to make some kind of big political statement like that?
Did she say that she won the presidency?
No, I don't know. I hope to God not.
Right.
All right. Thanks a lot.
My pleasure, as always.
Robert
God
Steinbach
bless.
Will be back with me on Monday. You'll want to listen because we're going to talk about Federalist Paper number 65, written by Alexander Hamilton. Look it up, read it, be ready to take a test on Monday. Tomorrow, I'll start off with J.R. Davis. He's going to join me here on the Dave Elswick Show.
Star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, deliver the truth, whatever the cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, deliver the truth, whatever the cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.